What's up, winter sports enthusiasts? Welcome back to Level 20, Episode 17, Pleasure. I am Connor Smith, Level 1 Summer Intern, your host. Pleasure is free for you to watch at podcast.level1.ski, so go check it out. This movie's I Trip Through Zigzag will be free until November 10th, so time is counting down for you to go watch them for free. Our romance premiere tour continues to roll on this week. Shows in Prague, a free one in Minneapolis, Whistler, Boone, North Carolina, and LA. Coming up next week, Sandpoint, Steamboat, Stowe, Bend. Week after that, first week in November, Boulder, Colorado, Durango, Vienna, Keystone. Lots of Colorado shows. You are well covered, Rockies people. It is all on the events page at www.level1.ski. Go check it out. It's not too late to host your own premiere, too, if you don't see a show near you. Our DVDs will hopefully be shipping out during this coming week. Stay tuned. We got a lot of pre-orders. Thank you for your patience, but excited to get those DVDs in your hands. And the digital release of Romance is November 5th on iTunes and other digital platforms, so keep an eye out for that. Also on the website, we have our new Wells Lamont collabs, new Spy collabs, new RMU Ski collabs. Those are awesome. Go give them a look. Lastly, if you have questions, we are going to be recording the last three podcasts this coming weekend. So send them in. We want to do a little mailbag. I know we have some unanswered ones that have been sitting there for a while everybody has been gallivanting around Europe. We've been dropping these podcasts we recorded weeks ago. So thank you for your patience. Send them in via email if you have questions, podcast@level1productions.com. We had the great pleasure of talking with LJ Strenio this week about a ton of different stuff. So enjoy this interview and then some extra details on the movie after that. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yo, how's the NASA internship, dude?
It's all right. It's going.
Have you been to the moon yet?
I can't talk about it. No, I've just been in I've pretty much just been in what you'd expect, like a little laboratory with like little lasers and stuff, and like just sitting at a computer writing code. Mm. Kind of boring, but pretty exciting.
Because your Insta post the other day, I thought you might actually be on the moon at the time.
I think some of the stuff I'm working on is going into space, but not the moon. It'll go to Mars probably.
What are you doing for real? Like what's the program?
I'm working with the center of Matt is all like research technology, and my mentor pretty much invented like a new way to use fiber optics to do like super high fidelity sensor, get sensor data for like pretty much anything, but it's really applicable to spaceships and airplanes. It's going to be like, it'll be on every airplane in like 10 years. Like Airbus is like buying a bunch of these units right now, but it pretty much is just using fiber optics to like get readouts about like integrity of a hull, the temperature, like, I don't know, pressure, fuel gauges. You can use fiber optics for like all these things that people didn't know about.
Damn. That's about it. So that way we'll be able to prove when Dave Lash crashes his next airplane into the ocean.
Yeah. You won't be able to fake it.
Word. Sounds like a really important piece of technology. That's sweet though, dude. Is that are you looking to like transition out of skiing soon and make that the year round full time thing? Or is it always going to be back burner half and half?
I think skiing's looking to transition me out of it, and I'm trying to prepare for it. eventually. I'm not like a Wally or a Henrik or even like a Will Wesson. I think I'm starting to see the light at the end, but skiing's so dope, dude. I don't want to stop until I have to. So
I'm just you never have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to ski forever, but I don't think I can convince companies to pay me to ski for much longer.
Yeah, that's sad to hear, because I think there are going to be a lot of people who are bummed to not have you filming cool stuff to watch.
I think you got a few more years left if you want it. But at the same time, it's cool to see people taking the bull by the horns and transitioning into a career path that seems like a really cool thing, man. Like, yeah, this is not you're getting your real estate license, which is not an altogether bad thing, but it's pretty awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I've been working hard, so.
Yeah, yes, you have. Actually, on that topic, you were probably one of the few people who I have a number of memories of you doing school work before, during, and after shoots and just like cranking.
Damn.
Yeah.
What a nerd.
For real.
Friedel's mic is live. I don't think he realized that.
No, that's legit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Legit.
Multitasking like that and with a future in mind is something that's pretty rarely seen, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And learning stuff besides like new tricks.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of just was like always like my friends give me a hard time about it because I've literally been in college for like 8 years. I took a break in between, but I don't even have any graduate degrees. It's just like, I don't know. I'm just like, I didn't know what I wanted to do basically. And so now I'm like excited to be in school, but honestly, it was just inhibiting like all of those ski trips. Like Berman, you just said, it was honestly just, we'd ski all day. There's so many trips where I'd be skiing all day and then have to work on homework at night, which works. But like when you want to like unwind or something, it can be annoying, but oh well.
Yeah, I mean, you still got it done. That's that's definitely true. Well, I'm going to give you an intro here. In case it wasn't clear from the first part of this conversation, we got LJ Strenio on the line joining us from the moon. What's up, LJ?
Not much. Just glad that we got a good, clear radio signal from the dark side of the moon over here. Good to chat with you guys.
Fuck yeah.
Coming through the fiber optics.
Mm-hmm. Glad we put that cable in. Word.
So before you even get going, I want to tell a little bit of a, I guess, kind of funny story and actually get your perspective, LJ. One of my first memories of who you are was a Super Unknown entry.
Mm.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Like
Super Unknown 3.
Super Unknown 3. So that'd be 2006.
Yeah.
2006. And if I remember correctly, not only did you put your name and your phone number at the end of the video on screen.
Nice.
But I think there's this like gap, like multi-gap kink rail, and you didn't quite get it in the video, but it said something on screen like, I got this clean after the filmer's battery died, but I swear to God, I got it, or something like that. Just like on screen text that was like, I did it.
Yeah, that was like my first what, white whale or whatever, the white buffalo. Sure. Just that's in Burlington. It's still there. I think people still hit it, but it was a gnarly rail at the time. Like the gap there, yeah, there's just a bunch of gaps in a multi kink rail. And Henny VJ made that video, and he also also shot that rail. And yeah, it was like dumping snow, middle of night, super cold. I've been hitting it forever, and I think the camera died like on the hit. Somehow I hit it and the camera like wasn't running, or it had died, or something happened. And it was like the thing I did that year. It was like the biggest shot I had gotten. I was so devastated. And I was like, we're just putting this in and we'll just write a little note or something. High school logic.
Like an asterisk, but like for good things.
Like, oh, man.
That's actually the first shot I remember you on that rail too, because growing up in Vermont myself, I remember looking at that rail way back in the day, being like, well, that is never, it's not possible on skis. Like snowboarders can 50-50 it, but you can't, the way that it's like, what is it? Like, how many kinks is that thing?
I think it's a quad kink, but it starts and ends on with flats. So it's a little different.
Yeah. It's like, you just can't hop those gaps on a quad kink in 2002. Or that wasn't a mindset that we imagined was possible. But yeah, I think I saw it. Did you also go back and do that in the Meathead movie the following year? I feel like that you had a shot in the Meathead movie on that rail, but probably not from the same session with Henny.
Yeah, I did, but we skipped the top flat because then we decided that like you had to get onto rails from the side, like urban style. Mm. And so we thought it would be less lame to skip the first flat than to get on straight on the front of the rail. So yeah, we did hit that again. But I think it's actually less cool now because we skipped.
Yeah, there was a period there when there was very strict rules.
Yeah.
Like, especially when skiers did not adhere to those rules getting into street. And then, like, when, like, the snowboarders started being super, super, like, I remember, like, the Quebec guys would have, like, video cop, like, you can't do this. Like, your kicker can't be more than 4 inches high. It has to be, you have to hit the rail from the inside only. And it has
so many rules.
Yeah. Like, so, yeah, so many things like that. That's
Frank
funny.
Raymond.
Yeah. He was like the Quebecer that was learning from the snowboarders.
Head cop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chief of police.
Hmm.
But no, it's like those rules are actually really limiting. They're like cool for a certain type of street riding. But now it's like, yeah, how about I just do whatever I want to do?
I remember Wallish early on. He basically said, fuck all that. And I remember him building, he used to get shit from some people for building really big jumps on a features. And he basically was like, fuck you all. Nobody else is doing the shit I'm doing. Mm. Like, yeah, you want to come 450 onto this dub kink? You build the biggest jump you want. You still can't do it. And it was true.
Mm. Yeah, I remember the year that he was saying that a lot. And it like really resonated with me. And I was like, he's totally right. Because he was doing like, I mean, throughout all of this whole series, they've been talking about all these different years. Wallish has like been setting precedents as an urban skiing. And like, he's totally right. If you're doing something no one else is doing, like, honestly, the people don't remember the details. They remember that you were doing something crazy they'd never seen before. And it wasn't like he was building massive jumps. Like,
sometimes
giving himself a little extra pop. Yeah, I mean, but I just don't remember.
Yeah,
I,
like, well, I remember. Case in point, man. It, like, it goes both ways. I think if somebody, you know, there are shots that I remember where people are doing tricks or hitting features where there's virtually no jump whatsoever and they're ollieing on or nollieing on or whatever. I mean, Keegan's stuff this year, for example, like some of the stuff that he's getting onto is like no jump and it's crazy. I mean, you can see, I mean, a bunch of dudes as well, you know, they've you know, made a thing for, you know, doing peanut butters and pressing off their tips and tails, but like, It goes both ways. Like, I completely agreed with Walsh at the time, and I think there's definitely something to be said for that. If you really are pushing the boundaries, like, yeah, do what you need to do to like, don't handicap yourself if you don't have to.
Yeah.
Based on this arbitrary set of rules that, like, wannabe skateboarders made up.
So true.
Yeah, man. And yeah, to your point, LJ, like, if you're doing really cool shit, and that's what Walsh always said, like, just who cares?
Yeah, and so much has changed from now to the, from then to now too. Like back then, it was much more like the add-on style pursuit. Where I think now that we're seeing it more commonly going a more creative and like less traditional way, like no jumps at all and stuff. It's less about like trying to provide a like a medium to do the next coolest trick, and instead like finding like a different way altogether to hit something where you're not just trying to, it's not about like adding a 180 onto your trick. It's now like, let's find something that doesn't even look like you could hit and then find a way to hit it.
Sure. I'm going to go sideways for a second here. What or who inspires you or who, when you're looking at what's going on in 2019, do you think is really killing it?
Man, it's so broad now that
exactly. I mean, that's why I'm curious, because you definitely have a particular style that you are known for, and like what do you look at and say, I mean, whether or not you care to emulate or follow that path or not is an entirely different conversation, but what are you looking at? Who do you see? You're just like, damn, like that's really impressive and really cool.
I mean, the first people that like come to mind right away are like all the young guys right now. They're doing, I mean, honestly, I like a lot of like contest skiers, and I know normally it's like, it's supposed to be, you're supposed to like, you know, I don't know, people that are also doing street skiing or stuff more similar to yourself, but I love watching, and it's hardly contest skiers even, but like people like A-Hall and Hunter Hess, I love like following their social media accounts because they're always doing like weird, crazy stuff, and seeing like Mac Forehand, who's like super young, up and coming contest guy, like, I've always loved jumping. I've just never been very good at it. So I love watching them do like super big, crazy technical stuff. But then like more on like the street side of things, like, you know, me and Alex Hackle are like both on the O'Neill team. So we've spent some time together the last couple of years, and like, I'm a huge advocate of Hackle. And I guess I'm not sure how much stuff we're supposed to talk about because I'll get figured out, but there's gonna be a ton of really sick video of Hackle this year. So he's someone who, and I wouldn't even say, I mean, I would say we have very different styles, but anytime I've skied with him, you don't necessarily have to ski with someone who skis the same way as you. If you're both having fun, I don't know. I've had a blast skiing with him, and I think he's going to keep doing really crazy stuff.
Are we going to see him in X Games this year?
I don't know.
I feel like that's a question for you too, Burin.
No, I was kicked off. I was fired.
Oh, really?
Yep. I'm too old.
No, yep, come
it's
on.
40 and under. I'm 41 now.
Yeah, sorry, Berman.
I'm actually filing a lawsuit. Age discrimination.
It is. It's age discrimination. I think it's all getting figured out right now. Nothing's set in stone.
Because if you guys really fuck it up, then I'm going to come back next year and just straighten shit out for you.
I will say that I would really like to see him in X Games Real Ski personally. I think that would be awesome.
Well, yeah, I mean, even last year I would have loved to see him. Hackle's on a tip.
He was on the bubble last year. In fact, I remember personally putting him near the top of my list last year.
Mm.
But not everybody wanted to listen to me, and then they fucking fired me, so what do I know? Nothing.
Well, since we're talking about Real Ski, let's we'll talk about your real ski, because we're going to talk about Pleasure eventually. That is the movie that this podcast is based around. But yeah, I want to know what I do know a little bit about your mindset going into that real ski. But can you walk us through that year?
This is year one.
We're talking 2016, right, 2017.
Right, the year.
The ham year.
Well, computer programmers, they start counting at zero, and really the whole story starts with the Pleasure year zero, because after Small World was like the most fun year ever. I haven't heard the podcast yet, but you know, I didn't hit any urban Small World year. We just went on like super fun trips.
No,
all
you
around
did,
the world.
Man. We went to Japan. You hit urban. You hit that waterfall wall ride. You hit the swings or the slides and.
But it was, I think I had maybe like three urban shots, which when you're like an urban skier, that's like, you know, I didn't go on any other dedicated urban trips.
Yeah,
so then when they chose the first year's real ski athletes, you know, the year of Pleasure, I very reasonably was not, you know, and there's all these big dogs who like deserved, you know, they'd like put in work over years. But anyway, since I wasn't selected, the year of Pleasure, the reason I feel like that was one of the harder years I went with level one. And it was because I didn't get into that, and like watching Will going to spots with Will and watching him do all these tricks, I just wanted to be in so bad.
So to clarify, Will Wesson, this is the Pleasure year. 2016 was the year of the first ski street.
Right.
And Will was filming for that, which he eventually won gold in. And you were kind of his wingman, I believe, for like, at least the beginning of his filming tenure there.
Yeah, like all the local stuff in Utah. That's one. There's a lot of downsides to real ski, like trying to film segments simultaneously. But one good thing is that it's like it's very everyone's down to help out. Like you're all in the same boat, and so whenever he needed help, I was happy to go help him. In the following year, when me and Kai were both going back to our real ski year, when the first year that I was in Kai's year, we spent our New Year's and New Year's Eve and New Year's Day helping each other hit features. Like it was like midnight. I was behind a winch, running the winch at like a school with Kai. Damn. And then we woke up early the next morning and he was behind a winch running me into something.
Holy shit.
Spent a few New Year's Eves doing that.
Yeah, I guess they honestly in the ski world that's not that crazy.
No, New Year's Eve
is like a money spot for getting shots. But
all those holidays, but bus factor goes way down.
It's also, I think your point is that you guys were technically competing against each other.
Yeah, and you know it's you can put that aside and just, you know, the goal is to make a cool video.
Did you really sabotage the winch when Kai needed it?
It's unconfirmed.
Put sugar in the gas tank.
It was bad gas.
I did feel really bad about that because it really came down to, he put together like an amazing video, but he had so much trouble, and it literally came down to the fact that they don't pay you money up front to make this video. And Kai didn't have like the capital to be making this. So there was times where he was just kind of shit out of luck. And I remember offering to like lend him money because I really wanted him to like make the best video he could. And he literally couldn't afford, you know, Jacob Callahan, who, you know, filmed a lot of the stuff for Us and Pleasure too.
Sure.
He was filming, I think he filmed Kai's, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure he just was doing it all for free. Maybe he got money down the line.
I think I'm going to say, did I pay him?
Oh, right.
I might have done something because that was definitely like kind of on the side through level one in some way because we got access to that content. I forget the exact details, and maybe I didn't pay him up front. I don't remember, but
I forgot that. Yeah, that. Well, I forgot that level one was kind of supporting a lot of this,
somehow involved for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I just knew Kai didn't have money himself, which is a bummer.
Sure.
So was that motivation from not making it in the pleasure year like a pretty big driving factor in how you started off filming that part in 2017?
Yeah. As soon as I had started school at the beginning of 2017, the year after pleasure year, when I found out I got in, I had just started to go back to school. And it was my first semester back, and I started like mid-September. And I was like 3 weeks away from finals for finishing the semester. And I found out I got in, and it also simultaneously snowed like maybe like 3 or 4 inches in Salt Lake. And that was all it took. I immediately withdrew from school, lost the whole semester, and drove to Salt Lake. And most of it melted by the time we got there. I hadn't even skied yet that year.
They call that dedication.
Stupidity or dedication, or sometimes these things. But I got to Salt Lake like Thanksgiving, and Jake was there like 2 days later, and we farmed a bunch of snow, and like the first trick I did on skis was the backflip to the pillar we built it out of sand and farmed like just enough snow for the in run. But it, you know, it worked out. I just retook that entire semester in the spring. But I mean, it was worth it for me. That was one of my favorite things that I got to do. So,
dude, let's talk about that backflip to pillar stall. I mean, that goes down as one of like the all time ski stunts in the streets. Where did that even come from? I mean, that is like the most.
Curious if you had the idea for the trick like that before you found the feature, or if you found the feature and you were like, I want to backflip onto this.
Kind of the latter. We were just trying to find, as soon as I got in, it was like after school homework. I would go on Google Earth, go to every major city that got snow, and just spend all day, every day looking for new features to hit. And I found on Google Earth in the foothills of some Utah city, like I just found this structure. And I couldn't even tell what it was. I could just see that there was like something up in the foothills. And I was like, there's going to be snow up there. And then as soon as I got to Salt Lake, I drove down there by myself at night and saw that there was a pillar, and didn't really know there's a huge rebar sticking out of the top of it, like impale yourself rebar.
Lovely.
So my original plan was to like, maybe like air and wall ride into it, like air to fakie, and then come back out. And then it kind of slowly developed. We cut the rebar because it was still dangerously sketchy being up there, even just to try to like hit the wall. And then I was like, oh, maybe I can land on top of it. And then I think I was just like walking back up to hit it. It's like, Kai, I might try to backflip onto this. And I hadn't really gotten a good hit on it yet. So it slowly developed, basically.
Did Strassman know?
I don't know if he knew. I think maybe I was like trying to like force myself to do it by like semi claiming it, like, oh, I might backflip. And everyone was like, no, like, I remember Kai being like, dude, you don't have to do this. Like, you have like your whole season ahead of you.
You have a future, man. You have a life to live.
Well, and if you watch the crash reel, all of my attempts are in that crash reel that Jake put together. And sure. I wasn't getting close to like getting to like stalling straight air onto it. It's actually easier to backflip though, but watching the straight airs fail, everyone was like, no, you can't even land on it. Do not try to backflip.
Yeah. It's one of those crazy things. The trajectory just kind of like puts you in a better place to come down onto it, rotating through a back, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was that. I needed stitches. I like, there was a bunch of broken glass and I fell and I like fell in the broken glass. So we like duct taped my elbow and just kept going.
Why not? Has any filmer or friend athlete that you were with at any point in your career ever put a stop to you hitting something? Just been like, don't do this, LJ. It's not worth it.
No, really? I don't think. I've had times where I feel like I've had times where maybe someone wants to say something and they kind of give you that look and they're like, they'll like, if the closest I've come is probably Jake, like pulling me aside, looking me like close in the eyes and being like, hey man, like how do you feel about this? Like, what do you think? Like just trying to like get me to say it's a little sketchy so he could say that it was like, but I mean, just validate it. And I feel like usually, I don't know. I feel like that's like one thing. Usually Berman, you could probably speak to this because you've probably been at some of the craziest urban stuff that's ever happened on skis. So you've probably like been in that position. And I'm sure it's like I would imagine it's not an easy position. You could probably speak to it, but you need to like walk that line of like, because it's also kind of your job to like motivate the athlete, you know, and they're usually almost always capable of doing this stuff. It's just keeping them in like you were talking about with a Met, keeping them in that headspace.
Sure.
Yeah. Being a cheerleader.
I think there's a fine line between motivating and pushing.
Mm. Right.
And I've always stayed on the side, I think, of motivating. I've definitely cut things off and cut people off where either something was getting started and I just didn't have good vibes about it and thought it was like too dangerous and too sketchy, or when we were just like talking about options and things to do and somebody wanted to set something up and my response is just like, fuck no, like that is not okay. Like, I mean, Friedel, I know you feel that same way as far as just like,
I do. I just can't think of many examples where I've actually put it into play because I don't really work with wild cards. People. Yeah. I mean,
that's another thing. That's another thing too.
It's only happened once, and that was because it was a backcountry situation, and I felt very strongly that the avalanche danger was too strong to.
The word wild card, I'm actually glad you mentioned that because that's something that we haven't really talked about yet. As far as the athletes that we work with, and LJ, you're certainly one of them. Like, we have a relationship with you all, and I think that there's some degree of trust in our understanding of your skill sets and what you are all capable of that makes us comfortable filming the high risk level that we're operating at. And it really comes down to knowing and trusting the people that you're working with. And that's why few and far between are the situations where I've allowed some random person to just jump on a crew, if ever, that doesn't come through you all as athletes or other film crews that we're familiar with. I mean, that's a huge part of it. And it's interesting because we kind of see it every year. It's super unknown where all of a sudden we have 10 or 11 people that we've never worked with for the most part or never even met or seen before. And you could definitely see differences in how people approach things and the people that are just a little more risk averse versus the people that are just like, man, I'm going to go for this whether or not I can handle it just because this is my shot. And it's like, whoa, don't do that. And I mean, the best film day you can ever have is the day where everybody comes back in one piece, regardless of whether or not you get a shot.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, you got some crazy ass shots for that real
ski. So are you or are you not a wild card, LJ?
I don't want to be, but I'm probably kind of a wild card.
No, you're a wild card that, speaking as somebody who's spent a bunch of time working with you, you're a wild card that I have faith and trust in. If you're going to line something up, I feel like if I was in Jake's shoes, and Jake is a very even keel, very mellow dude, and I don't think that I would have felt any differently. I think if he gave you the seal of approval on moving forward with that, I'm sure I would have in the same situation too. Obviously you had it.
I was going to say, I can't remember any times where you ever pulled on the reins with me.
No, I don't think so.
I felt like I always had in Ogden, that gap over the, so I can't think of a ton of super gnarly dangerous stuff, but that one was me and Banks were kind of struggling with speed.
Sure.
And it ended up not being a problem at all. But that's one of the only super gnarly things I could think of where there was a potential for
you're talking about the alley gap,
the alley gap,
double fence.
Yep. Mm. But even in that case, I felt like by the time you guys sorted out the speed thing by basically putting the winch by the takeoff and having to cut a 90-degree corner wakeboard style into it, I think that when we figured that out, there was no question in my mind, a worst case scenario, you're still getting over the fence.
Yeah. It ended up being super chill. And as soon as one hit was done, it was super chill.
Yep. I took all the measurements. I had my yellow pad out. I was doing the equations.
Radar gun.
Well, dude, LJ, on that topic, we got that turbo winch. That was the year that we first ran it.
Yes.
And I went and I got a radar gun on Amazon, and I had this grand ambition to put this thing in a field with you in particular. And it was we're going to see how fast this thing is going to go. And I've got a radar gun, and we're going to get LJ going 100 miles an hour off this nosed out turbo winch. And so I'm sorry, a correction. It had NOS and not turbo, but it actually had a NOS tank. And there was this big red button. You turn the dial to engage and open the lines. And then if you wanted to, you could push this button. But that winch got everybody going so fast. We never used the NOS. We were afraid.
The best winch ever.
It's sitting in the garage right now.
It's like a Subaru WRX.
Yeah. Well, dude,
that's the one-handed one, right? It's the mini one you're talking about.
It weighs 45 pounds, full of gas, and you could walk around with it uncomfortably, but walk around with it carrying it in one hand, which is crazy.
Oh, my goodness. It was fast. It was portable. It was light. It had torque. It was powerful. It was everything.
It was amazing, except it was a little Formula One vehicle, and it was not designed for longevity, and that little aluminum frame rattled itself to pieces, and there were probably a half dozen times we had to find an aluminum welder in some random town somewhere and get them to work on it, but it's still functioning today. We actually replaced the engine because that engine blew up, but it was first off, the original engine, this is a crazy story, was this $100 just cardboard box deal from Harbor Freight. And Johnny Durst had a buddy in Bozeman who worked at an engine tuning shop and was turning these things into super tuned, crazy. They put it on a dyno and that thing generated 40 horsepower or something ridiculous without the NOS, which it says 6 horsepower on it, but they I don't remember all the technical details, but they bored out the carburetor or something like that and just did crazy shit. And so it was a little Formula One vehicle and it didn't really stand the test of time, but I guess it did because it's still working today. But shit was crazy.
So good.
Well, it got the job done for a lot of crazy speed stunts in this movie. And particular, a couple that stood out to me in the Will Wesson real ski mixtape ish segment in Pleasure, the Cork 9 in the park, and also I would guess in the same park the double tree gap with the sniper through the two wide trees,
double field goal.
Yeah, exactly. And Friedel, you mentioned that might have been a Will Wesson spot. That was Friedel's recollection.
I think I mentioned it. And LJ, correct me if I'm wrong, but I was the one that shot that with you. And I remember you mentioned something about Will didn't think that was possible.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. Because Will was jumping through a bunch of trees that year on a rail.
Always.
And I really wanted to, I might have stole the idea of a double tree gap from him. I don't think I did, but I should at least acknowledge that that's a possibility.
I'm going to say you might have absorbed it through osmosis, because that's definitely something that Will had been formulating, at least in his mind.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And then I found that one. So I was looking for it, and that one was not, even though, you know, there's probably more impressive, bigger ones that would be less gnarly than that, because even though that was low to the ground, the angle with the branches.
So tight, dude.
It was very tight. And yeah, you're fully right, Berman. Will was like, you know, he's either like, it's not possible, or that's like sketchy. You're going to like clip the first one and go sideways into the second one. Like, don't do it. It's a bad idea. And I was just a little stubborn, and Berman was like in Salt Lake and was like, yeah, let's shoot it. And do you think you can do it? I think. And it ended up being actually like, it was scary. I don't think I wanted to hit it a lot of times, but it was pretty chill. Like, nothing ever went wrong.
Just threading the needle. I got my notepad out for that one as well, and took some measurements, and it lined up. So it's like, LJ, send it.
Well, clear, you had like this very straight trajectory. The shot almost looks fake because you're like not going up or down. You're just kind of going like straight across through these two trees, like at the perfect angle.
They were like pretty far apart. So I had to go like super fast, and it was winching down a hill, or like across a baseball field and down a hill to get speed.
That's right. I think that's probably one of the only times I've encountered a situation where you're winching down a hill.
Yeah, it was.
That was crazy.
And actually, that was like the
goddamn Vin Diesel.
Oh yeah, exactly. I was gonna say the reason there was like the tree gap in the XXX movie was that was like a month and a half later, and they were like, we need to do cool stuff in the jungle. And I was like, oh, let's jump through trees. I was just doing this.
Did I just unintentionally tie that in?
Slip it in there. Right,
nice. Give us the rundown.
Are you getting
on
royalties
that
for XXX?
Oh yeah, I just got a check like 2 weeks ago.
Hell nice. Yeah, dude. Give us the quick rundown on that, because that's some pretty far out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was Carl's thing. He was down there with the Sweetgrass guys. They shot their forest segment in their Valhalla movie, which was pretty cool. And it was on YouTube, and the producers saw it and wanted, you know, they're literally just comb
stunts.
YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's how they found all the other guys. I was like hanging out with all these longboarders and motocross dudes, and they're like, yeah, my like longboard video had like 500,000 views. And so that's how they found Sweetgrass, hired them on as like contractors to shoot it. They brought Carl down, and Carl just had, there's just like a bunch of weird stuff. There was a dead body and some other stuff going on, and some
like
of
an actual dead body. We're talking like a prop body.
No, they found a dead like homeless man in the jungle.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know exactly that.
Okay.
I honestly don't know the details of it, but I'm pretty sure Carl was the one that like stumbled upon it.
Yeah, it's just one of those.
Carl killed the dude. What?
It's one of those things that you never want to have happen in your life.
Definitely not.
It's completely just a side peripheral thing to the shoot, but.
It seemed super creepy. And then there were some really cool stunt guys. This dude, Todd Schneider, ended up being this old ski dude who I still keep in touch with today, who ended up being the man and helping out. But the other stunt coordinator was just kind of a dick and was, I don't know, just super. I think they still owe Carl money, and he just like stopped pursuing it. But they're like super strict with paying actors and stuff in SAG or whatever. And he didn't get paid. So it's like super lame, but he was over it. He didn't, you know, they had him like dangling from wires and stuff. And he was like, I'm not about this. And, and so I had done three back-to-back trips. I think we did, you know, we filmed in Salt Lake, and then it snowed in DC, and then it was to Denver after that. It was like, it was like nonstop urban filming with level one for me that year. So I was like, I'll take 2 weeks off. Yeah. Like sign me up.
Mm.
And then it just became this whole intense thing that I'm glad is over with, but is cool to talk about.
Yeah, no doubt. And you get that like down payment on a house or go to school, go back to school money or whatever.
It's definitely paying for my whole education.
Hell yeah, dude.
Yeah, you mentioned that Denver trip. There's the, like, I've heard it called around the office the super kink rail in the kind of like the Shea Lee
13 kinker on South Broadway.
Okay, flatly gonna beep that one out, but
wait, what rail?
There's like a 13 kink rail at a school off South Broadway here in Denver. And actually, you know what? I think I first got a spot leak on that from Paul at Tall Tee. I think.
Oh, word.
And yeah. You tried to shoot it, or you did?
We did. Well,
no,
I want to
hear about that session from you, LJ. What? How big of a battle was that rail?
So that was all Sandy Beauville's rail. Like, you know, we were trading off spots and stuff, and that was a good one that everyone, you know, over the years, skiing has become much more like one person at a time. But that was a spot that I think we kind of were all able to session, but it was kind of Sandy's thing. Like me, I think it was me, Will, and Kai were the other ones there. Is there anyone else maybe? But we kind of were just playfully hitting it, and Sandy was getting really close. The metal actually was very sticky. You know, urban's one of those things where it's like, there's a lot of factors that you just can't convey over video necessarily. Like a sticky rail can be hard to see sometimes. But it was really sticky, I remember. And so none of us really wanted to hit it. And Sandy was getting really close. And then I think out of boredom, I just started like hitting it quite a bit. I mean, I worked really hard for it still, for sure. But it was kind of like a luck thing. And I didn't even come off, you know, I wasn't like the cleanest on the rail, or like, I didn't like lace it up perfect exactly. And I was still kind of hoping Sandy would get it. But I mean, it was just such a crazy rail that I think anything on it was good enough to go for sure. Just a wild rail.
The most important thing, man, you came off the end super clean and in control. And like, that's like make or break on those things. Because Sandy, to the contrary, man, he didn't move a muscle for 13 kinks, came off that rail at 90 degrees. Cause I think the last little like 2 feet, it wasn't even a donkey dick. It was like straight up like 2 feet of flat. Came off at 90, didn't move a muscle, and then never moved a muscle, and just like landed at 90 and fell over. It was like, oh my God. It's like he had a brain freeze or something. But like, dude, it was heartbreaking because he just had it so flawlessly dialed. And then it was just like, ka-chunk, just like flipped over.
And didn't you guys go back again later?
We did. We went back like another day or two later, and he probably hit it like another 150,000 times and didn't quite get it, but yeah, man, you did, made it in the movie. Good job.
Damn. Sorry, Sandy. Sandy's got married, so congrats, Sandy.
Congratulations, Sandy Beauville.
Word up. Are there standout shots? Let's talk about this DC trip, because not a very common place to film urban, and also a pretty cool crew. What was that?
All those sessions. Opener part
as well. Yeah. Thank you, Friedel.
I was really stoked on that, actually. I know maybe people don't care about that, like opener and closer or anything.
No, people care. Cool people, I mean, we care. We care, and we're talking about this podcast, so please go on.
Yeah. And that was a shared segment, too, but, you know, in my head, at least, that's definitely like, I don't know. I was definitely stoked to see that, but
you opened the movie, man. You definitely opened the movie.
But yeah, I think if you ask anyone on that trip, so it was me, Kai, and Jonah skiing, and then Johnny, Jacob filming, and Seo taking pictures. And I think if you ask any of those people, they're like, what the best urban trip of their life was, or just like an all around good urban trip. Most of us will. I mean, there's probably other ones too, but I always go back to that one because it was like all the things you don't get on urban trips that you desperately want. It was a ton of snow, super warm. It was pretty short, so it was easy to like, you know, do the grind and you know, bang out a bunch of shots. And, you know, a few days later, we were, you know, already like on to the next fun thing to do. We had an Airbnb instead of like crashing on couches. We had like a whole house. There was like a bunch of Bud Light Lime in the fridge when we got there. So we were all like,
what?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, it was super comfortable. And it did rain the last day, and the snow like eventually melted, obviously. But then we also, you know, we weren't going back to the same Minnesota whatever rail over and over again.
Right.
This was like a new city with, you know, there's kind of limited real estate to find rails. So like, you know, it's more finding the nooks and crannies is what you're usually doing in old reliable cities. But this was just clean slate. Every rail would like never even been looked at before by someone.
Right. It's not like, oh, Jed Anderson did that 4 years ago and like whatever.
Right.
Yeah. And the rails were sick. Like the rail Kai, we should talk about the rail Kai hit because.
Hold up. But another thing that made that good for you, I think, is you guys shot exclusively in the daytime, which was like happened to be a bunch of sunny days. It looked like no nighttime stuff during that trip. Is that right?
No, we had. I think Will decided that he didn't want to hit stuff at night anymore. Or maybe even Berman, maybe you were part of that. And then it was like starting to rub off on us at that point. And it was just at that point, I feel like unless we needed to hit it at night, you know, at school or something, we were all like super game to avoid night shoots because, and you guys have discussed this earlier on the podcast, but just setting up lights and a million other things, it draws more attention and, you know, it's just
pain in the ass,
dude. You know what?
If you're trying to hit rails every day,
hey, it fucks your sleep schedule up.
That's what I was gonna say. That first night where you stay out until 4 a.m. just like fucks up the rest of the trip. Because then you like either wake up at a reasonable hour and you're too tired to function, or you sleep till noon and all of a sudden you're out of your mind and it's just like it's no good.
Yeah, you guys are clocking out at 6 and going to Dave and Buster's. For happy hour.
We got Bud Limes at home.
Yo, but are you talking about the Kai rail that's like a...
Yeah, it cuts you off. He does a
like quad kink to gap over the rest of the kinks?
Yeah, that rail was... If you pause it, you can just stare at it for a while. Like, Kai is he is small compared to that rail. And it's just so steep. Being Kai just gets everything so quick. He has the best balance in skiing, but it looks scary. It was a gnarly rail, and he got it really quick, but that's a very unique rail. I've never really seen a rail like that before.
Dude, side note, you mentioned Kai's crazy ability to get stuff quick, and that actually just takes me back really quickly to our Japan trip for Small World, where that motherfucker got that crazy, probably like 120-foot, like five kinking elbow rail.
Like one of the opening shots.
Yeah, one of the opening shots of the movie. Or certainly the
90-degree kink in it. Yeah.
He got that in like maybe 8 or 9 tries, to the point where we're really fortunate that we were actually shooting, because it was like one of those situations where everybody's just kind of messing around. It's like, let's get the camera set up. I think they're going to start hitting this thing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he just laces it. It's like, oh. Well, that was it. And then you and I, LJ, everybody else took off, and you and I hung out for like 30 more hours and never got another shot on that thing. No, dude. Yeah. I mean, that's like, that's a human moment. I mean, that's like pretty normal that, that you couldn't get it, but it just kind of speaks to Kai's just like obscene ability to just like, stick his rollerblades, skis to the rail and slide through it. But no, man, I mean, that was nuts. Anyway, super sidetrack, thought I'd bring up that little memory.
Cool. I totally
you tried real hard, man. You tried so hard.
I mean I'm not even bummed. That rail was tough. It's Kai is just Kai has the best balance. I came to terms with that a long time ago.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say all the rails on that trip we were either doing really creative tricks, or the rails themselves were just really creative.
The fucking double S rail, like that
quadruple
thing,
S rail,
right? That thing is so cool.
And it had natural speed. It was just in a public park. That's the most fun urban rail I've ever hit. When we looked at it, it's perfectly flat, and the S's were like pretty small radius,
like tight.
So we were worried it didn't look like you could get to the end of it. It looked like if you were going slow enough to actually hit this thing, that you would not be able to make it to the end of the rail, because it was actually like, it was probably like 45 feet long or
it
something.
It was a lot longer than that, man.
Maybe 45 feet, just like if you drew a straight line or something. But yeah, maybe even more. But the cool part about that rail was that because of those short radii, we actually, once we got used to it, we started pumping the rail. And it's pretty obvious if you look at the shots that we're actually generating speed. And if that rail kept going, I think you could literally just kind of maybe not indefinitely, but we were generating speed, and speed ended up not being an issue at all, because we were literally able to pump the rail back and forth to keep us going forward.
It's like so one fun. Of those those foil things in water.
How yeah. Hang on 1 second, LJ. How fast do you think you were going when you hit that thing?
Not crazy fast. Like, I don't know, maybe as fast as you like casually ride a nice bike or something. Maybe 15 miles an hour, maybe a little less.
Okay, and how many S's did you say it was?
So it was like 1, 2. I think it was maybe, was it 5? It was like 2.5 S's, I think.
Okay, I got on my yellow pad. It was 91 and a half feet long. And hang on one more second. Okay, yeah, you guys were generating enough speed that you could have made it through 7.5 S's if it continued.
Confirmed.
Confirmed.
That checks out. That checks out.
Friedel verified.
I also have my yellow pad. The idea of pumping a rail seems fun as hell, though.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah. Well, that's the funny thing. I'm glad you brought it up in that context, because I do remember talking to either Johnny or one of you guys when you got back. And you were super hyped on it, and you're just like, yeah, it was one of those things that we did not think it was going to work out, and it was actually a lot of fun, which is one of those really rare but super awesome surprises when something works out better and is easier than you thought it would be.
Or is fun. In general.
Yeah.
Like doing something, like a street tends to get not fun very quickly for a lot of people anyway.
Yeah, definitely. It's type 2 fun. You're getting pleasure from the, like, seeing if you can do something. That rail was, if I was there, like, you know, if I could be there right now hitting that rail, I would go and just goof around and hit that rail. It's so fun.
What's the most type 2 fun you've ever had on a street spot?
Ooh,
that Z rail. How about let's move right into that Z rail, because that was some type 2 fun. You took some slams on that thing, right?
I was just already super beat up, and it wasn't like horrible slams, but my whole hip was like massively bruised, and there's
like
one
me on the mini ramp.
Oh yeah, you guys have a new ramp,
dude. We do.
It looks sick. Oh, I'm hyped for you guys.
Yeah. Cooks come only, on to the premiere,
Cooks,
maybe.
Cooks only, man.
I wish. I've been skating down here because there's nothing else to do in the desert.
Hell yeah,
dope.
Well, next time you come to Denver, man, come shred the mini ramp. It's actually a lot of fun, and even like old people like me are having fun on it.
That's rad. Yeah, I definitely will. But yeah, that rail was a lot of hard work, but it wasn't the gnarliest, but it was very up there. And some of the falls, I just like slammed my hip super bad. So it hurt a lot, but it was generally like a smaller, just super technical feature.
It gets old, like when there's no exit zones.
Yeah.
So you're just eventually going to have to take some bars to the shin or wherever else, or hip or chest.
Yeah.
And that just probably gets old. No,
that's not fun. Yeah. Like the S-rail. Mm. You're not pumping that thing.
Yeah. And each section you clear, you know, if you're committed to the rail, when a rail is continually bending back in towards itself, like elbowing back in towards yourself, if you're committed, like it doesn't matter how far down the rail is. Like if you fall inside, then you're going to hit just the next section of the rail.
Right.
Which definitely happened a lot, but it was a fun rail. I was psyched to get it.
Dude.
Clearly the video very much shows that. It's just like the biggest sigh of relief ever.
So you said you were going to cry. It was subtitled. You're like, I'm going to cry.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought, I really wanted it. It was exciting.
Dude, really quick, we were talking throwback to Les, because we just talked about this in the podcast the other day. But
yeah,
dude, that shot where you run into the building in New York and break the tips on your skis that ended up in the movie.
Yeah,
dude, I got torn apart for putting that in the movie.
I know, that was a big source of drama, and I felt bad about that because because ultimately it was my fault. Like, because it was funny, and like,
you should have told me to take it out of the part.
I know, and yeah, it is exactly what it was. Like, in a snowboard movie, it would have gone in because it was cool.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, I honestly didn't think it was like a huge deal either. And then
Nor did I.
And then I don't remember if it was Josh or Jason, but when they brought it up, I was like, oh yeah, I'm sorry. That probably
it was Josh.
Look good.
Sorry, Malchek. I apologize for bringing this up twice. We love you. We love Lion Skis. Buy Lion Skis. Super durable. Look at the crazy shit that LJ does on his Lion Skis.
Yeah.
That's what I always say. I always read like New Schoolers and stuff, and people are like, oh yeah, lines break. And I'm like, who are you? I'm like overweight. I'm way heavier than all you little kids. And I definitely ski at least as hard as you. And dude, yeah. It's funny. I broke the chronic slamming into that wall. If you ski into a wall, yeah, you'll break your chronics. Dude, I rarely snap ski. Like, I haven't actually snapped a ski in probably like 2 or 3 years, and the last time I snapped a ski was like probably doing something
running into a wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it pleasure? Was the gap, the roof gap to wall that didn't quite work out? Was that that was pleasure year, right?
Oh, roof
gap. Was that Small World?
Oh, that was that's in Utah. Some sort of redirect
with Mitchell. Yeah.
Awful.
Dear
God, I was there for that.
Truly.
I had to put myself back in it for a second. That was that year where, oh my God, dude, that was nuts.
Wait, that year being pleasure or Small World?
That year being pleasure.
Okay.
So that was that same trip that was the same trip that I came out to shoot with you and Mitchell, and we did that double tree gap and everything else we've been talking about. But yeah, that was this crazy gap off the roof that you'd scoped out. And
yeah, it's like a Tony Hawk Pro Skater 2 gap.
It is nuts. And I remember Alex O'Brien, I think it was Alex, came out, right? To shoot photos.
And Wiley shot.
Wiley
drone.
Brought his drone. No. Yeah. Yes. And what was really crazy too is that was like a, you know, pre-dawn mission. I remember shooting you driving, like it was still pitch black dark when we were like getting there and like gearing up and then climbing onto the roof. And like, dude, we were ready to go long before the sun came up, like speed checks and everything.
Oh
yeah.
Did this make it into like a self edit that you did from that season basically as kind of the audition tape to Real Ski, LJ?
Yeah. Yeah. I put together I sent like all my clips basically to all of the judges at Real Ski. And I put that one in. It was pretty loose, but I was like missing the, like, I wanted to have like something big to like show that I could like go big
to show that you're crazy.
Yeah, that thing's fucking massive, dude. What? Oh, I'm glad you brought that up.
It's doable. It just wasn't. And the good thing is that Mitchell did that. And so what did go in the movie is that pocket air that Mitchell did, which I think is like, it was shot like super skate style, where he was kind of going over the cross of the camera from one side to the other. And it's concrete to concrete.
That's nuts.
Out safety that I think that shot was super sick. And that was part of that whole kind of multi-day build and zone exploration. So it all kind of ended up for the best.
Yeah. Word.
But let's just talk about, you're talking about Real Ski for pleasure year. I'd just be curious to get your take who you thought should have won, because that was the first year of Real Ski Street. And definitely from my standpoint as a judge, the hardest one I think that we've had.
Josh and I were both judges for that one.
You were a judge as well.
I was.
Yeah, you were.
Will got gold, JF got silver, and
Clayton Vila got silver.
And Wallace had a very controversial non-podium.
And Ahmet not far behind him. Yeah. Dude, that was And then Cam got hurt and kind of had a tough year, and he was the only one that wasn't necessarily
in the running.
In the running,
yeah.
When you have five dudes in the running, and like
nuts.
Cam, to be fair, probably would have been in the running too. I'm sure he would have been if he had had a solid season. But that was insane. I mean, that was like breaking the seal wide open on that event.
That must have sucked to judge. It's not fun. I can't imagine judging because. That there was five.
No, judging is fun. It's judging when you're actually a judge that's not fun.
Yes.
Actually, one thing I want to take a second to set the record straight, because there were some bullshit claims being pushed around.
There was.
That I, in particular, and Friedel to a lesser extent, were very biased because the level one supposedly had a horse in the race. And that
in the first year?
Yeah, man. There were people involved with that event that were claiming that I was trying to push Will as the winner. And to be completely honest, and I've told Will this before, JF had my highest score. And moreover, yeah, absolutely. And then moreover, there was no horse in the race. Like, I had nothing to do with it, aside from the fact that level one was paying Johnny salary and they were using our gear. And that we were going to put that content in the movie. That was our horse in the race.
Which is a horse in the race.
It is. But it is an interest that I think is nice to hear was not borne out by your judging ranking. Because it's certainly... It's very easy to see how people could go to that conclusion.
Here's the thing, though, is that if he wins, like, there's nothing that I or level one get out of it, because for one, all that content that's going to go in our movie is first and foremost pushed through a million different channels for X Games.
Right.
So that's primary usage. Secondarily, like, cool, like whatever deal Will and Johnny had to share prize money in whatever way they decided was entirely up to them. Level one didn't get a dime.
It's just optics, though.
Oh, it is optics, but you'd like to think that the people involved with the event in whatever role they are have an understanding that goes beyond just the base level.
People optics. Involved with the event, I would expect that from. People on the complete outside of it, it's harder to see that for sure, because you don't know what the deal with you and Johnny and all of that is. And then when it shows up in the movie, you're like, well
I think they also thought people from the outside were just chirping that we had some beef with Wallace, which is couldn't be farther from the truth. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's controversial every year.
Sure.
But let's clear the air. Will fully deserve to win, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. And, you know, like, I will say that for correcting my statement, like, at the time, I definitely gave JF my highest score. And I walked out of there feeling like he had the best combination of going huge, being very technical, having a very well-done edit, being creative. Like, he checked all the boxes for me. Not that Will didn't, and I will not argue that Will took the gold that year. I don't think he was undeserving because,
right.
You know, very clearly at least two or three people that year could have had the gold. And I mean, similarly to last year and a couple other years, like it can definitely be a toss up, and it's not so much as like one person being undeserving of it. But I mean, that's just how when you are put in a room and forced to like create a situation where there is a first, a second, and a third, and a fourth, you have to come up with something. But not only was I not incentivized, but I also like didn't think that Will at the time was my favorite or the singular best edit.
Another part of judging that was that year we didn't get to watch the videos ahead of time.
Oh, yeah.
So it was all based 40% of this. It was fucked. 40% of the score at least was overall impression. And that was based on first
one
impression.
Watch.
So it was because they wanted to film a TV show where they got us to react.
They're filming our reactions
to the videos, which is actually it was whack, but it's actually kind of not whack. Like
there are benefits to it.
There's certain benefits to it, like that initial gut impression that it lends itself to certain videos more than others that are like have some deeper intricacies that you need like 10 watches on. But it put us on the spot. So like we all held up numbers like we were figure skating judges. I think I had 10s for both Will and Amet. Just because I was like, that was just my initial thing. And, Yeah. I mean, and then we got to mull over it for like another hour later, and then we had to come out with our top three. It was fucked. Like,
but putting scores, okay, if you were putting like actual numbers to them immediately, that makes a little more sense.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that's your very first impression on watching a video.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty gnarly, but I mean, interesting.
It's just a different thing, man. Like, I personally like to be able to watch these things and go through the fine tooth comb, because I'll tell you what, on a first watch, I am not digesting who's spinning natural versus unnatural and just like adding up all the different like technical combinations in my head. It's very much overall impression, which is important, which is really important. And I think
it is,
it's just different approaches.
Yeah. And I mean, like I will die on that hill of Will Wesson winning that competition, because in my mind, I went in there again. Like, I don't know if I was the most qualified judge, but I've certainly have been in the trenches with Filming Street over the years. Not in recent years, like leading up to that necessarily, but like that in my mind was like, oh, this is the future shit. Like, I'm looking for future shit only. And like, what has the most, well, it's just like, I don't know how to put it into words necessarily, but what gives you the feeling of like, wow, this is like breaking new boundaries. This is not like filling in blanks of what a video should be. This is like creating new blanks. New
stuff, yeah. So, you know, it's funny.
That was Will for me. There was no doubt about it. So, felt good about that.
I think that if anything, my relationship with Will and Johnny was probably a handicap for them, because I've held them to a higher standard than anybody else, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
Also, JF, who will give me 50% of his winnings. So, I mean,
but that's what ultimately screwed Wallace in that competition, is he was held to the highest standard based on his previous work.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard to isolate yourself from like, knowing what else, you know, his like entire
body of work.
And it's really, really, I think he like almost put himself into a Wallish corner there. Because that video could have definitely been a podium. But
I think
I lost sleep for days after that contest.
I think you could have taken those five dudes, put all their names like in a hat and like, picked them out one by one, and then come up with a very convincing argument for the results.
Yeah,
definitely.
Same thing with last year, man. I mean, that was pretty gnarly. You were a judge for the first time ever.
Yeah. And I wasn't expecting it to be fun, and it was super unfun for sure.
How
it's the same deal. You could make an argument for a lot of those guys. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what happened, is you had like apples and oranges and pineapples and pears,
jackhammers,
and bananas and fucking bulldozers, and like, you can't compare them all in a very in an easy way.
Let's hear the other side of the perspective, though, because we just heard a judging perspective. You were a contestant in 2017. How did it feel to like, you're not a competitor? I mean, you probably did some competitions East Coast style, but how did it feel to like be in a competition for a video part?
I mean, do you mean like the process of filming it?
When it came down to the finish line, like the judging.
I mean, I guess the
process too. Like, how do you make a video that is going to win? You just do you. Were you trying to fill in blanks?
I was just trying to go absolutely 110% on everything. I just wanted to do like, I like made a list of all the urban stuff I'd always wanted to do, and was like, I'm going to do all of this in the next like 5 weeks, and was just trying to go like just balls to the wall every minute the whole time. And it was so draining and like devastating.
Yourself out to dry, man, literally.
Yeah, like Berman, I remember seeing you in like the lobby of the hotel, and like, yeah, I like couldn't like, I wasn't sleeping. I like couldn't see straight. Like, it was rough. And then to be like, I'll be honest, you can't, it would be a disservice to yourself to work that hard at something and be okay with anything but like absolutely winning.
Absolutely.
And so like, you know, as time's passed, I'm like, you know, I'm like perfect. I'm stoked. Like, it's so cool to have like an X Games medal and stuff. But, you know, at the time I was definitely, I was pretty devastated. I really wanted to win.
Of course.
It was hard not to, but I would never argue that I should have won or that, you know, because it really is, it's ultimately taking something that's qualitative in nature and trying to, you know, quantitatively arrange people. And so it just comes down to a lot of it. When you have stuff like the first year, there's a lot of those, like comparing to, like you guys are just saying, comparing like Tom to Will or something is just completely different takes on something that doesn't have like a right or wrong answer.
Right.
And so, you know, the further away I got from like, you know, the day where it was all announced, and I wasn't bummed. It was a weird feeling to have like an X Games medal in my hand and also like simultaneously have like a pit in my stomach.
Sure.
It was like just like a weird mix of emotions where like, I don't think anything would satisfy you at, it was kind of like a Frodo at the end of Lord of the Rings. Like, you did it. And it's like, yeah, but you can't live in this world. You never come back. Like, you can't go back.
Okay, who wins this year?
Magnus.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And Henry's second. Yeah. Go on, LJ.
There's a lot of good videos. But I mean, yeah, that was it. I'm just kind of
Were you pissed rambling. At me as a judge?
No. I wouldn't say I was pissed at anyone. And I hope I didn't. That was my biggest regret now is that I'm so self-conscious that I hope that I didn't seem standoffish
or angry at anyone.
Because it was just a mix of emotions. And I'm so psyched. And, dude, it breathed a bunch of fresh air into my career. And my habit segment is maybe my, like, possibly my favorite segment I've ever made.
I'm going to say it's your heaviest part I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. I'm super hyped on it. So, you know, I think I just needed... It was a lot emotional. You put that much work into something. It doesn't matter what the outcome is. It's going to be super emotionally fatiguing. So, yeah, that's real talk, honest right there. It was intense, but I'm super, I wouldn't have had it any other way. I'm super hyped for the whole experience.
We watched your part in Less. Clearly you're very emotional. And then Helen reminded us in the voiceover that you wear your heart on your sleeve. So between those two things, I think we're, it's communicated pretty clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys should, I'm sure if we don't talk about her now, that's probably one of the biggest changes with that movie is the introduction of, you know, starting narration.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. I don't, where did you guys find her? Cause she was so perfect.
The internet. So let's back up a little bit. Friedel stepped up huge for one. I think coming off of what was a very fruitful filming season and a lack of involvement in the post-production of Small World the year before, I feel, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I feel like Friedel was very motivated to assert a creative direction.
Yeah.
And we kind of just like let you take the ball and run with it and go ahead.
No, that's right. I think we were talking about it off mic, but, that's absolutely correct. Cause I wasn't part of the editing process in 2015 for Small World. Cause I was pretty burnt on editing after making the movie Less and needed kind of a mental health break / creative reset. And it definitely gave me that. And coming into Pleasure, I don't know. Sometimes ideas just fire and like you can get a kind of vision of how you want to make something. And that was something that was, you know, I have to like write down notes as soon as something fires up there. Cause then sometimes it'll leave, it'll go into
forever.
The mm-hmm. ether. But, I think I was driving through BC coming down from Golden after like a whole month of filming early season up there. And I was like, oh, like we gotta have a narration. It's gotta be a British female. Like
that was it
in my mind because I had also come up with Pleasure. I don't know if we had a working title before that, but maybe we did. Either way, I basically co-opted my good buddy, whose house actually has a starring role in the movie, has Tyvek on the walls. Made a like a selfie snowboard video probably like 10 or 15 years ago called Untouched and Ready for Pleasure. And I don't know. Pleasure just stuck in my head as like a, as a word.
I think there's like a vein running through this whole thing, because at one point I was either Small World year or Less year. You floated the title idea of Spank.
That was, yeah, unrelated, but that was just to be as edgelord as possible.
Do you guys see that level one movie, Spank?
Provocative Images was another one, I think.
Yeah, Provocative Images is really good. I still like that. I think that's awesome.
Because I have a folder.
Nobody fucking steal that. We're going to do something one day.
That's mine, dude. That's mine.
Friedel's.
Yeah, who's we? No. No. That's fair game. I used to collect a folder of inspiration, like in a notebook binder, like a three-ring binder, and put clippings from magazines.
What's
and
a binder?
Yeah. It's like a
Trapper Keeper? Yeah. Do you guys even know what that means?
It's like Pinterest.
Jeez.
Oh, it's like Tumblr, but like printed but out
real
paper.
Life?
Yeah. But it was called Provocative Images. I had it like written on them, but it was all just cool photos and shit. Anyway. Yeah, I just was like, I don't know the exact first lines, but I had like the beginning of the pleasure narration written out, and I could hear it in my voice as a British female, because I wanted something. If we were going to do narration in a narrated movie, I wanted something as far away from like bro culture as possible, and something to completely offset that, just like a bunch of dudes skiing in a movie. And it's like, a female voice for sure. But then, and then the British thing is just like something about a British voice. And I was actually talking to Helen about it, who narrates our movie, but it's like you pay attention to it. It's like this might be an American thing, but it's like a voice of like reason or like an elder. Like it's like David Attenborough.
Intelligence and like eloquency.
Yeah. Like David Attenborough narrating
Planet Earth.
Planet Earth.
Yeah.
But obviously didn't want that. So, that's where that came about, which I think was like a left field take on narration in a ski movie.
Well, yes.
It's almost satirical, I feel like.
In a sense. It is. But the thing is, like, if you look at narrated ski movies, and narration has had a major role in ski movies since day one. Starting with Warren, and everybody up until like the 80s was narrating a ski movie if they made one. But then you had like Greg Stump narrating his movies. And then like even if you watch Tanner Hall's movies, they had like Shane Anderson narrating it. Like he's just like, and these guys are going to go do this. And it's like, yo, like shut the fuck up. So, I mean, seriously, like, it rubbed me the wrong way, and I wanted the opposite of that.
It's funny. I think it was a couple years before we were brainstorming ideas, and somebody, it was probably me, brought up the concept of narration, and Friedel is one of the more passionate ideas people. Like, when Friedel has an idea, gets behind it 100%, and it's... the sword cuts both ways. And I remember having a conversation up at 3333 and talking about narration. You're just like, dude, fuck that. If you need to narrate, it means that you need to tell your viewer what's going on. And it means you're not successfully communicating with your visuals. And I was like, yeah, okay. Yep. That makes perfect sense. And it's true. I mean, there is something to be said for that. And I was
narration is a crutch for poor storytelling.
It is.
Cause it just does it for you.
Show not tell or whatever.
In ski movies, we're not filming we're not truly filming a documentary that tells itself. And also, even in documentaries, like if you watch like Grizzly Man, like Werner Herzog is narrating that bitch. So like you need to kind of move the story along. Even Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino movie that came out this summer, like has a narrator pop in from time to time to be like, hey, so anyway, we're going to cover the next 2 months here real quick. But
We'll fast forward real quick. That's how you get through that. But, but I remember, Friedel, you, Shuey, Johnny and I were at Snowbird, and we had like down day, sort of like a creative meeting, if you will, talking about post-production process. And you're just like, this is it. This is the title. It's going to be a British woman narrating, and this is what
I think
feeling.
I pulled over on the road in Cranbrook, BC to tell you guys that really? Over the phone in February.
Maybe.
It was so definitive in my mind. I think then we doubled down on it in Snowbird, but.
Well, either way, I remember sitting there in Snowbird when you're just like, this is like definitively like what's going to happen. And I was like, all right, fuck yeah. Voiceover narration. Like, let's do this. Cause I'd been wanting to like dabble in it for a while. I did not have the inspiration or like a direction to go. And ultimately, you know, if Riddle had the creative juices to get something done that was new and different.
Mm-hmm. LJ, what's your, cause I like it and it's, I think it works really well as a movie, but you know, considering how long the level one history of movies without narration was, I think it's got a good bit of backlash. What was your take on this as a writer and a fan of ski movies in general?
I mean, I was a huge fan of it. I can see there being a struggle when you have a formula that's been so time tested and successful and. Just like, you know, all of my favorite movies growing up followed that formula. But also, I mean, just not overthinking it. If it works, it works. And it was just, it added such a lighthearted vibe and just was just fun and just added this consistency throughout the movie that, I don't know. I thought it was super fun to watch. And I also, I think it did, even though it didn't, you know, even though a lot of it was just kind of playful commentary, you know, my parents watch the movie every year. So like my family watches the stuff and, you know, they don't watch it for necessarily like the ski
the
porn
bears.
Aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it, they all loved it. And I think that's kind of spoke to, you know, it added some like broad appeal, which I know isn't necessarily the target of these movies, but it certainly doesn't hurt. And that appeal also makes it more fun kind of for everyone.
There's no
my
question.
Girlfriend loved it.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I mean, pleasure has the broadest appeal of any level in movie made, for sure, for that reason.
Jumping off that, and I think this might be our final question for you here, because we're running deep, but...
yeah, no worries.
I'm curious what you think of having, you know, movies that are based on flow and travel and trips and themes, which Small World and Pleasure... really stand out as in, we were just talking about the last one is a very much a response to less being like super, you know, a shit ton of rider segments that are very cool and all like, you know, like border on a little repetitive by the end of the movie that you're just like, oh wow, there's another person in this movie. But there's, you know, maybe something lost in there too, to the athlete who likes to put something together for the whole season. So what's it like for you watching your whole season spread across a movie like this?
I mean, yeah, it, as far as like trying to have all of your clips in one place, it's definitely, it feels like less of like an oomph or whatever for your, you know, what you have to show for the year. But as far as like one formula being better than the other, I feel like there's no right or wrong answer. It depends on how much footage you got that year and what year is it. You know, if it's been rider segments from every movie for the last 10 years, it's a breath of fresh air to have like, you know, some of these fun trip segments. And then when you have a trip segment, you start to have sometimes a little bit of a story element and some maybe behind the scenes mixed in, which can be fun. But then, you know, now we're getting to the age of social media where, you know, where we're kind of missing those pure segments again. And so I feel like it makes sense maybe to start. I think it's kind of like a balancing act and it's kind of swaying back and forth. And now I feel like maybe it does kind of make sense to, you know, it's going to end up, I think the best move is somewhere in the middle, but I think maybe trending back towards closer to like rider segments rather than pure trip based segments is starting to seem more appealing now. So I think it depends on the times and what you're working with.
The pendulum swings.
Yeah.
Yeah. The pendulum swing. Yeah, exactly.
Word. That was very eloquently put, dude.
Thanks.
Yeah. Any final questions for LJ from you two?
Boy, I feel like we covered a fair bit.
We covered a shit ton.
How are the hot dogs doing?
Thank you for asking. They're good. They miss me desperately. I flew home last weekend because I had like a long weekend and got to hang out with them.
OJ has Maddie dachshunds.
Yeah, 2 miniature dachshunds. I'm a softy.
Dude, if you want, take this opportunity, plug their Instagram accounts. I know that one of them has 180,000 followers and the other's 250,000.
Maddie and Nova on, yeah, follow at Maddie and at Nova. No, I don't know.
Hashtag dog influencers.
Yeah.
Sick, dude. Well, any final thoughts or shout outs from you, LJ?
Just say thanks to these guys. I know it's kind of just repeating kind of what Amet said and what other people said, but I grew up watching Level One, and it's been awesome listening to this stuff because, you know, it's kind of like thinking your parents have everything together when you're a little kid and you find out like, no, like we were struggling. And by the time you were aware, it seemed like we had our shit together, but listening to like the first few episodes when you guys were just like fully inspiring me to hear that, like, you guys were like, didn't know if it was going to even work yet. And in my eyes, you were like this epic thing that like was fully, you know, never, I don't know. It was super fun. Cool to listen to that. So to get to be a part of it, and now to get to kind of reminisce with you guys has been, a pleasure.
Cool. I see what you did there.
Yeah. So thank you. And I guess, yeah, thanks to, yeah, all of you guys and whoever else made it happen, all the sponsors and stuff. Super rad to be a part of it.
Thank you, OJ. We still have no fucking idea what we're doing, by the way. We're just making it up as we go along.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what happens next because I think you guys you're going to have a lot more freedom to hopefully do some more really cool stuff, I'm sure.
In theory, anyway.
I'm sure.
Wait a second. I read on New Schoolers the Level One was going out of business.
No.
You
guys have been very, very clear that you just no longer annual features, so we can do other cool stuff.
Yeah.
So. Dude, Jeff Crico posted on Instagram that he's like, yeah, Level One is done. And this is like, no.
Well,
no.
People mean different things when they say done. So, well, like,
he thought done, because I corrected him. He was like, dude, I'm sorry. I got it wrong. Like, it's like, we're not done. We're not done.
Well,
I think it's probably going to be super novel. You guys, there's so much novel stuff that you can now like sink your teeth into now that you're not bound to this
big time.
I know, it's very exciting, very liberating.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you guys are, you, this isn't the end, this is for you guys. It's probably like this, you guys feel like you're starting something.
Level
Everyone's
two,
like, oh, it's ending, and you're like, no, this, we're beginning.
Yeah, what does the saying go? Like, a window closes and a garage door opens or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Barn door.
Yeah.
Nope.
LJ, well, thank you very much, man.
Yeah.
Sorry to cut you off, Connor. You're going to say the exact same thing, so now you can thank LJ.
Thanks, LJ.
Hell yeah. All right. I'll can't wait to hear it. I'll catch you guys later.
Part two of the Pleasure Podcast. Josh, why the fuck did you decide to go to India? What's the, like, most random place to go ski ever?
Because shooting rails in North America got boring. let me see. I think I was bitten by a bug at that point to try to explore new places. And I think in particular going into this year, one of my goals was in the shift away from the athlete focus segment to create some interesting travel, if not stories, just like themes and adventures. Cause that stuff for me, was a little new and fresh, if you will, to try to just do something a little different. And those were some of the segments at that point in my life that I found interesting and entertaining and just like bringing something to the table. And it's like, where could we go? Actually, you know what? Part of the inspiration initially came from Rory Bushfield, of all people.
Really?
Yeah.
Bushy.
I think I'd bumped into him the year before, and I don't exactly recall where. And he hit me up. He's like, Berman, let's go somewhere. Let's do something. And I don't know if he suggested it to me or I suggested it to him, because it had been like in my back pocket that I want to go to Gulmarg, India. But anyway, Bushy's like, absolutely, let's fucking do this. This is going to be great. And so he was like a pivotal like part of that equation.
It would have been a very different trip.
Yes, it would have.
Wait, so he was so on that trip?
He was in spirit on that trip. He was scheduled to be on that trip until 2 weeks before we left, and he was at X Games, and he was commentating and or hanging out as a Monster ambassador, and he decided to hit the big air jump, but then he bailed like right before the takeoff and ended up like side slipping, and basically he fell off the edge of this like 30-foot tall lip to flat and bruised his heel or broke his ankle, and all of a sudden was on the disabled list.
Oof.
And dude, he called me and was like, "Berman, I can't believe I did this." Like, oh man. And it was,
so he would have been coming as an athlete?
He was going to come as an athlete. Yeah.
That's
so
dope.
Obviously,
as a Rory Bushfield, as
right. alumni appearance, but it's not like sure. he was coming as a, like some brand rep to just
he was coming as a Bush Wayne.
Yeah.
To be Bush like, Wayne. Do some.
Yeah. And for me, like, obviously, I have a history with Rory, and I was so excited to be working with him in some capacity. I mean, he's just such an awesome, fun, highly entertaining dude. In retrospect, considering some of the things that we went through in India, might have been borderline dangerous to have him with us. So maybe it's a good thing that he wasn't there for the trip. But sadly, Bushy had to bow out. And at that point, I want to say it was Bibby and Rain, or Bibby and Wiley, were already committed to the trip. And I think we filled that last spot with Laurent. I think that that's how it broke down.
Dope.
Because Laurent, who had made an impression a couple years before at Super Unknown Finals, where Mitchell Brower won, and Laurent, there is no runner up award at that kind of thing, but certainly that's where we get to like meet people and hang out with them and see what they've got going on. And Laurent was somebody that definitely impressed us in every way. I mean, he's just a good, like, very centered human and nice person, and obviously very talented skier. So one of the problems, kind of like side note here, that we've run into over the years is that when you work with somebody based out of Europe, you don't get these panic trip opportunities. Like, oh, it just snowed. Come on over to Denver, or come on over to Utah, and we're going to log some shots.
Right.
And so it's a little tougher to break the ice with those people. And so I think we kind of sat on Laurent for a year, and then it's like, man, like, who has the interest, the ability, the budget, and the wherewithal to be able to come to India? It's like, fuck yeah, Laurent, you want to come? So he joined, and which was awesome. So fortuitous, because I mean, he obviously became a big part of a crew for the next few years following that. And you know, my introduction to working with him was nothing short of awesome. But, anyway, we go to Gulmarg, India, which was even a more far out place than we ever could have imagined. I mean, I remember thinking of Japan as being a very crazy experience. I know Johnny De Cesare had expressed to me before I went, he's like, man, it is upside down world. Everything you're used to is completely fucking backwards and upside down and inside out. And I remember being like, oh yeah, like that's right. Times 100 with India. I mean, just like one of the most like chaotic, just wild, like far out places that I've ever been in every way, in great ways and in bad ways. I mean, all in, it was the experience of a lifetime and something I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to do. But it was fucking nuts.
Yeah. That Bunny Hill segment with all the locals like getting in on your jump sesh is really fucking nuts. What was that like?
So one of the things I will point out is we went over to India with the idea of shredding some big mountain, like sub-Himalayan peaks, because, you know, Gulmarg, I believe, is the highest or second highest lift service terrain in the world. The top, when you get out of the stage two gondola, is 14,000 feet, which is pretty fucking high.
Yeah.
And, you know, you are effectively the base of the Himalayas there.
Yeah.
And there is some really, really cool, you know, high alpine terrain. And that's really what drew us. I mean, aside from the cultural experience, like skiing wise, like that was what we went to do. And that's, you know, certainly what the athletes had in mind. And we show up and the conditions were pretty mediocre.
Yeah.
I think watching the segment back now, we made it look a lot better than it was as far as the on hill or on mountain, you know, pow slashes. I mean, we're talking like dust on crust. Like it was a little discouraging when we first showed up, and everybody had spent a lot of money to get there. We'd committed to being there for almost 3 weeks, actually more than 3 weeks, including travel. So that's a big chunk of the season
yeah.
in February.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because like the... Because
it looks like springtime.
It does. And I think ordinarily you go there in February and you're probably looking at pretty bottomless pow.
Mm.
And I mean, that's definitely like what we had in mind between bottomless pow and some high alpine heli stuff. Because we had a connection with a local heli operator. And so that was kind of in play. But anyway, like all that immediately went out the window when we got there. It was like borderline springtime conditions. And I mean, the segment kind of speaks for itself. So we were just like scratching and poking. The Bunny Hill segment, which was my favorite part of the whole trip and probably, you know, one of my favorite standout segments in the movie, just because it's so unique and so different.
Yeah.
Only happened because the conditions sucked. I mean, it's one of those things where you make the best of what you have and, you know, we're trying to tap into this resource and that resource. Like clearly we're not going to go spend our hard earned money to go do heli laps at that point because it would have been miserable. And then everybody would have been even more pissed off. So what do? We found a way to connect with, one of the two snowcat operators, or maybe it was the only snowcat operator and they had two snowcats. So I think that's what it was. Like one dude was actually qualified to push snow with a cat.
Damn.
And the Bunny Hill is actually on the golf course. And it's this little like T-bar service, like, you know, 50 vertical feet, like super mellow pitch. And, you know, we could see from where we're staying in our hotel. I think we walked past it a few times, like all these people just taking lessons, and it's just fucking comical. And I know we discussed it a few points during the trip, like, man, one of these days before we leave, we've got to get over there and just like shoot the ridiculousness. And actually, like I should mention, Robin Lee was another one of the filmers that the second filmer that I brought on this trip. And he was
really, you had two filmers for this trip?
Two filmers. Wow. Well, this was a big one because like, this was a big fucking deal. This was something I just wanted to put a lot of resources into because it's like, we're going to make something really special happen no matter what. And having two filmers just frees up so much of an opportunity on the filmmaking side to experiment and to push things and to just get more creative. And so I, after having worked with Robin the year before in Japan, I was like, man, he's such an asset. Like I want to get him involved in another trip. And he also being based out of Hong Kong, it was, you know, easier for him to travel, cheaper flight, like, you know, no big deal. And he's also just down for an adventure. He's like, that's one of the things that motivates him. Like, you know, we're not able to pay people like real world, if you want to say that, like filmmaking rates, what they'd make on commercial projects. But when you say, dude, you want to come to India and shoot skiing? It's like, sure, I will not charge an obscene amount of money for you to, you know, send me on this trip. Right. And so, I mean, that's definitely part of the draw and the interest. So anyway, we engineered this thing where we pushed up a little bit of snow on the Bunny Hill. And I think the original intention was just to have the dudes do a couple backflips and just like have it be this entertaining thing. And it obviously turned into a lot more. And it was, you know, one of the craziest, most like heartwarming skiing experiences that I've had in 20 years of doing this, because like just the energy and the excitement from all of these locals, like not just kids, we're talking like for sure, like some young kids through like middle-aged dudes to like older, like the full range of people just like fully embracing not only what we're doing, but trying it. I mean, you have dudes that weren't qualified to like make a turn, just like pointing it at these little jumps. And I mean, clearly that's what you see in the segment, but man, that was a crazy day. Funny side note, this kind of like ties into the India experience. So one of the things that everybody got at some point was what's called Delhi Belly. So sanitation in India is really not, I would say, on a first world level.
No, that's certainly not what any of you are used to.
No. Actually, like, I'm going to jump back in time here. The very first restaurant experience that we had after flying into Gulmarg. Actually, Dal Lake is this little town, probably an hour and change away. That's a huge tourist draw. I think the Beatles actually spent a bunch of time on a houseboat there and wrote a bunch of songs. I think that's part of the lore of this like crazy, like Kashmiri cultural experience.
What's that guy's name they were hanging out with? Oh man. He was like the... Yeah, sorry.
The guru.
No, you're fine.
Yeah, what was that guy's name?
Dude, there are gurus everywhere. Gurus everywhere.
Google it. Probably inspired a little Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Dude, that is absolutely the vibe of that place.
And 100%. George Harrison learned how to play the sitar.
Hey, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Points on points. So we go to this restaurant, which is by all accounts like an upscale restaurant where the wait staff is wearing like bow ties and white shirts that are kind of stained, but white shirts and like they're white linen stained tablecloths. And I remember having to use the bathroom and going in to the dankest, dingiest, scariest looking dungeon of a bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
There's no toilet paper. It looked like a murder had happened in and around the toilet. And there's a bucket of water. It's like grayish brown next to the toilet. There's no sink. There's no soap. There's no nothing. And I guess that the whole idea is when you're done using bathroom, you just use your hands and then dip your hands in this bucket of water to clean them.
Oh,
yeah, that's exactly my thought. And then this is again in like what seemed to be a pretty nice restaurant. So it was just like,
damn,
what are we getting into? So obviously that kind of speaks to the hygiene, and everybody got deli belly at some point from ingesting food that was contaminated with fecal matter.
Mm.
I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And there were various severities of deli belly from, I think Wiley and Elliot Bernhagen, who's the photographer that joined us, they might have gotten it like right off the bat. Jeff Schmuck got it the last like 3 or 4 days when we were traveling like in and around Delhi and going to like all the tourist sites. And we had to pull the van over on the side of the road like every 20 minutes so we could take a shit on the side of the highway. I mean, it was brutal. But you know what? That's another thing too. We went to a rest stop and he came out and he looked like he was going to cry. Because the bathroom area, if you want to call it that, in this rest stop was so horrifying. Like, the lesser of all evils is just to, like, squat on the side of the highway, which I think pretty much everybody did. So, anyway, the only thing that I really got symptoms-wise, like, I spent like, the better part of 12 hours one night just, like, locked in the bathroom. Like, could not leave the bathroom. And it was that next day that we ended up shooting the Bunny Hill thing. And I remember just like puckering up and like going to the Bunny Hill and just be like, oh, I can do this. Like, I mean, I hadn't eaten food in a solid day at that point, and like, I wasn't sure like what orifice was going to start leaking next, and just like, gotta fucking do this. Like, rigging up the Movi and the Red and just like having this crazy like carrot dangler easy rig contraption, and just like, which on its own was like, you know, a heavyweight device to be skiing around with for an entire day. And so I'm just like, core strength, huge, came into play. Somehow, I think it was one of those situations where I was so distracted and just like enthused by this amazing atmosphere that I forgot that my insides were rotting. Seriously, it's like one of those things where like, it was just this magical day where like everybody was just like all smiles and experiencing skiing in whatever way they were. Yeah. Like, you know,
which is so dope to see. Like,
so dope.
Like, all these people who have no idea what they're fucking doing, just clearly very stoked on like what's going on. Like, the vibe is high.
It was unbelievable. I mean, there's so many shots that didn't make the movie. And I know at the end of the day, there's this kid in a brown leather jacket who you see eat shit a couple times in the part. He finally made the gap jump at the end of the day, and he called his mom because he wanted to stay and like keep hitting this. And his mom was basically yelling at him, and he's like, no, mom, I got to do this. I got the guys, American guys, and like freaking out. And so he finally gets it, and Wiley gave him a pair of spy sunglasses, and this kid was shaking.
Oh, like, damn,
we're not talking like Casey Dean's hand shaking. We're talking like whole body, just like fits of like excitement. Because this was like his dream realized, and then he gets a pair of like neon yellow spy sunglasses, and he's just like, look, he was gonna cry. It was just unfucking believable. And the other thing that I will say is that it was also one of those experiences where you could not come close to capturing everything that went on, because like, for every obscene crash that we got, there were probably 2 dozen others that were happening behind our back or at our feet, and we're literally like jumping over dudes that are like catapulting their bodies down the hill and trying to not die and like record whatever we're seeing, and just like all in. It was just nuts. Amazing. And like one of my fondest memories.
Sick. That's dope.
The The Beatles had a different experience. I'm reading now.
Okay.
Their bungalows were equipped with electric heaters, running water, toilets, and English style furniture. For one, this is in 1968.
Bastards.
So they went to Rishikesh, northern India, to take part in transcendental meditation.
Drugs.
at the behest of the Mariachi Mahesh Yogi.
Mariachi. Yeah.
And the Mariachi. No, it is a famous figure in the 60s counterculture. But I was wrong about the album. It would have influenced the White Album.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, regardless, I feel like the whole like Sgt. Pepper's vibe was very much Doll Lake.
Do you do much transcendental meditation on the way to Alaska and that 80-hour drive, Friedel?
Before we get there, I do want to tell like one or two more quick India stories.
All right,
they're
fucking
nuts.
We're going to talk about the drone stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep the drone thread going.
Sure. Yeah. So drones. Drones. Hot on the heels of Small World, where everything was shot from a drone, and we were just like, I was trying to figure out how to top my experience of downing a drone in downtown Sapporo. So, of course, brought a few to India. And
you brought a few drones?
Well, I brought one and Robin brought one. And what's funny is that Robin brought, I think it was like one of the DJI Phantoms. And at that point, we had a partnership with, what was it? 3DR? 3DR.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so this was like this matte black, like military looking, like kill you drone. And it was really badass. Mm. And I mean, I didn't think twice about it. And of course, like we're just flying our drones wherever we want and no big deal. We had guides, we had fixers, we had drivers, because that's the other thing is you do not show up in like an occupied territory. A little bit of history, and forgive me if I get this wrong. But so where we were was technically Kashmir, and there was this longstanding dispute between India and Pakistan over who actually owned that territory.
Right.
So at some point, it was more or less, I don't know, decided in whatever capacity that the territory actually belonged to India proper. And there's just a lot of
India had the bigger army at the time. It was like, yeah, this be ours.
This be ours. Exactly. So... I mean, Kashmiri people borderline don't even identify as Indian, and they much more so identify as Kashmiri, if anything else. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, of course, the Pakistanis who are like, fuck you, you're Pakistani. It's definitely ours. And so it is straight up an occupied territory, and you have a military presence unlike anything that I've ever witnessed anywhere in the world. Granted, I'm not going to like occupied zones on the regular, but this was really just like kind of crazy. Yeah. And I mean, we're talking like checkpoints and just like, you know, huge presence of military personnel and just like loaded guns, firearms everywhere. So
a lot of people play an army.
Oh, dude, like one of the days we're like shooting actually up on the mountain, there's this huge black plume of smoke that just like pops up into the air from the distance. I mean, who knows, maybe 50 miles away, 10 miles, something like that. And our guy's like, yeah, that was a drone attack. Just like, just like super casual, like a drone just like,
you mean someone's trying to get some shots over there? What do you mean? Drone attack. Oh, that's what drone
no
means.
I mean, just straight up casual, like there was like a target that was just taken out. And I was like, okay, cool. Jesus. And like, we didn't necessarily feel threatened, but it was just like, it was crazy to think that that's what's going on all around us.
Yeah.
And then so my experience flying a drone down in Doll Lake, which again is like the more, I guess, like touristy and tourist accessible place. Like, and moreover, I think the point to make is that they rely on tourism as a source of income and revenue. I mean, that's really what like floats that entire region. And so anyway, like felt relatively safe, and it's just beautiful. It's unique. It's just like a really cool place. Like, what better spot to pop your drone up? And the light was a really nice one afternoon. Like, Robin and I are both flying, and then he's off shooting cutaways and on the ground I'm flying this drone, and people took a lot of interest. Like, wherever we were, like, everybody thought it was really interesting, and like in a good way for the most part. Like, people would crowd around, and of course you're looking at a little screen on a controller, And these dudes are borderline like elbowing to like get a look at what you're looking at, which slightly distracting and a little, I don't know.
Loose.
A little loose for sure. And I'm flying around and all of a sudden my guide is like, bring that back now. Bring it back right now. Oh. I was like, okay, dude, I'm like a quarter mile away. This is going to take like 5 minutes. And one dude I remember came up to me and he's like, oh, go over there. Like, let's see, let's go over there. And I like went over with the drone in whatever direction he was pointing. He's like, oh, you're spy, American spy. I was like, dude, no, like that's like, it was the first taste of this like kind of weird animosity or tension or whatever. And it was actually very shortly after where Matt Appleford, actually, I should mention Matt's name. He was the one, he's a Brit who lives in Colorado now and has been running these programs for years over to Goldmark. He's the one who's like, dude, just bring that fucking thing back, land it right now. And you can see in the drone shot that's in the movie, by the time I landed it, I was straight up surrounded by 10, 15 dudes with AK-47s. Granted, they're not pointed at me, but they are encircling me. And this dude's like, give me the film. Yeah. Give me the film. And before I could even like get a word out, I was trying to like, I didn't even know how to react. And I'm trying to explain like, oh, it's not film. It's a memory card. Do you want a memory card? Like, and he didn't even understand what that meant. But before I knew it, I mean, they were basically not physically dragging me, but like pushing me. They're like, you are coming with us. Like, and clearly like, I'm not going to argue with them. Like, that's not going to happen. And we end up going, it was like maybe a block away and across the street to the police station, which was very conveniently located right there. And it was not a very friendly interaction. I'll say that, where he basically states that they had received a bomb threat from, if it wasn't the Taliban, it was whatever like other major terrorist group was operating in the area. And he said that they'd received a bomb threat from them that morning and that I was suspicious because I was flying a drone and they were bringing me in for questioning. It's like, dude, like, come on. Like, let's be real here. Of all the people that might be associated with this terrorist group, do you think that the, like the long haired dude wearing like baggy clothes, hanging out with the skier guys is
I'm Josh Berman. Like, I made Strike 3.
Oh man. Well, he wasn't, he started watching at High Five. So I mean, that really,
true.
But anyway, there are some very tense moments and I was mentally preparing myself to spend the night there. And I was like, well, what is the absolute worst case scenario here? It's maybe that I spend a night. Oh, and they immediately took my passport. Because you have to travel everywhere with your passport in your pocket. Like, that is a no joke situation. So as soon as we like get to the police station, she's like, passport. And I mean, just handing over your passport in that kind of situation, like, again, you can't argue, but it's pretty fucking sketchy. And, he goes on and just like asks me all of these questions. I mean, borderline interrogation, and like, I'm not feeling physically threatened, but it's definitely, it's like an edgy situation. And all of a sudden his phone rings and he picks up his phone and he's like talking like pretty casually, but he's like angry.
In Hindi, or can you understand?
In Hindi. Like, yeah, I can't understand a single word he's saying.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he starts nodding and then he looks at me and smiles. He hangs up the phone and says, American friends, what can I do for you? And yes. So one of, I think it was our driver, called the Board of Tourism and basically said, they just took this dude. We don't know what's going on. You need to make some calls ASAP. And as soon as like tourism gets involved, it's like, this is the lifeblood of this area.
Right.
And like, not only are you going to let this dude go, but you are going to help facilitate whatever he needs. And so all of a sudden he hands me back the memory card and he's like, what can I do for you? Do you want to go fly your drone again right now? Like, what, how can I help you? I mean, like, the tables turn so fast. Like, I mean, my heart was like in my chest that whole time, just like pounding. And all of a sudden it's like, whew, all right, so I'm not going to spend the night in some like concrete, like bunker locked up in a cage. And yeah, I think we ended up flying the drone a few more times in the Dall Lake area. It was no big deal. And just like, whatever. Oh, the other funny thing that I'll mention. So they had taken a photocopy of my passport and then given my passport back to me. And I knew that because I saw the photocopy and they told me that they had a photocopy. And this random ass dude who was like friends with one of our guides came up to me the next day and was like, you know, do you want that photocopy of your passport? I think it's really important that you get that back because you don't want them to have that information. And I was like, he's like, well, here, like whatever the equivalent of like $2 was, he's like, pay me like $2 and a little spider will sneak into the police station tonight and take your passport.
Damn.
So I gave the dude the equivalent of like a couple dollars. The next day he just like poof shows up out of nowhere where we're like having dinner or something, hands me the photocopy of my passport and is like, and then just like walks away.
Damn.
It's like, that's how this place operates.
Well, there's much to do about bribes and stuff in that part.
Oh, straight up, man. Like everything.
Is like, Bibby like, this, is this even legal? Like what's that in reference to?
So the whole economy there is very much like this under the table, like just pay me for this, pay me for that. And I believe that the quote unquote resort, if you want to call that, is very government, you know, run and owned. It's not, you know, a privately run facility. And whatever lift ticket prices were, if you paid the friend of our guide, you got a much better deal. You're paying like, you know, 20% of the posted prices. And then like, you know, you're bribing this dude for this. And like, I mean, just like everything. I mean, there is some crazy situations. So driving in that country is like a fucking another level. I mean, the loosest situation I've ever seen. Like,
yeah,
not borderline dangerous, straight up dangerous. And like one of the crazier things that happened, Elliot, the photographer, started to open his door in what should have been a very safe place to open his door. And some dude was going the wrong way on a one-way street, basically like driving like on the equivalent of the sidewalk and smokes the door coming the other way.
He got a door prize.
So yes, if Elliot had been like 1 second ahead of where he was, if he had actually stepped foot outside of the door, he would have potentially been killed.
Yeah.
I mean, this dude like almost ripped the door off of this vehicle. And like, if Elliot's body was there, it would have been a fucking disaster. And so these guys like started arguing and all of a sudden their friends show up like, it's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. And then it was like, seemed like it was going to be a fucking lynch mob. I mean, it was definitely a very high stress situation. And our guides were like, okay, like you guys just go over here. And it was actually right by the bunny hill, actually. Mm. It was like, just go away, like stay away from this. And I remember like Robin and I were trying to like film it and like, cause it was so just like interesting. And eventually like somebody gave somebody else like $12 and then it like all went away. and I would like, no doubt there was probably, you know, in the US, the equivalent of like several thousand dollars of damage done to this car.
Right.
But it was like, here, huh. You know, it's like, take this. Okay. It's all good. And then like, the whole crowd of like 50 dudes just kind of disperses. It's nuts.
Yeesh.
And then one final story that just kind of speaks to the overall just like organization of this place. And not to speak poorly of the operation in India, because you know what? I would go back. It was an amazing experience. And I'd say for anybody looking for a ski adventure, put it high on your bucket list because it is very unique. It is relatively speaking, it's not like far out as dangerous as I'm making it sound, because we were probably pushing the limits of some of the stuff we're doing. But it was just the culture, the people, like it was wonderful. It really was.
Right.
And despite the Delhi Belly. And however, it is very well known for its unstable snowpack. And moreover, the entire resort.
Talking about the 10-foot avalanche crown that's in the part.
You mean the 15-foot avalanche crown that was at the top of the lift inbounds?
Yeah.
So the very first run of our entire trip there, we are going up the lower lift and we hear this huge rumble. And it's like,
Heard it?
Oh my God. Well, dude, that happened.
I mean, I didn't know if that was that fresh. Like it
happened while we're on the lift. And in fact, like
shit.
I couldn't see it. But the guys in the chair, either in front or behind, depending on like who had the vantage point, actually saw the thing fracture. So we get off the lift. And mind you, there are like two other people on the lift. I mean, this place is a fucking ghost town. We get off the chair and we're like mid-station, if you want to call it that. And we arrived to this situation where there is, I'm going to say like a 12 to 15 foot crown. There's a huge debris pile that runs from like 100 feet down to maybe 1,000 feet down. And we're talking like maybe 10 feet, 15 feet tall in places. And you have the dude who runs the lift standing there kind of scratching his head. This is inbounds.
Right.
And there's a very narrow swath of terrain that's actually listed as inbounds and is very supposedly avalanche controlled. I mean, not to speak of like everything else that is accessed off the gondola there. It's this giant ridgeline. You go right or left as far as you want. Some amazing terrain, but it all ends in a terrain trap. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like that whole area is just like, you're on your toes the whole time. And so inbounds, you'd think that you're a little bit safer. And in this case, it was very eye opening. I've never seen anything like it. Yeah. And you could hear Matt Appleford like yelling, like, we're all on search mode, because like all of a sudden a couple patrol people show up and they're just like suggesting to us very casually, yeah, maybe turn your beacons off or put them in search mode. And yeah. Like, you know, we got our probes out immediately. We're like primed and ready to like help, because nobody knew if anybody was even in there
yeah.
or how it got set off. Turns out the other snow cat, not the one that was helping us, but there's actually like a traditional groomer cat, was rolling down the hill and somehow just like set it off. Inbounds midday on a Tuesday, like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did he get taken for a ride in the cat?
He did. He did not get buried or anything. He just like coasted, like rode it down, right? Rode the wave.
That's insane.
It was nuts, man. It was nuts. And I mean, that was like morning or afternoon number one. Like we hadn't even set foot on the mountain yet. That was our first lift ride up. And it was like, this is what we're getting into.
Jesus, dude.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. Speaking of crazy, driving 65 hours. I don't even know. A lot of fucking hours all the way to Alaska. Some people would say it's crazy because they fly planes there. But I'm sure that was a fucking experience, both the trip and the skiing once you got there.
Yeah, that was another experience for sure. I've been obviously to Alaska a few times, both to Haines and to Valdez and Anchorage for street as well.
Mm-hmm.
And spent a lot of time in, you know, coastal BC as well. So it was like connecting the dots there. It was always an interesting thing. I don't know if it appealed to me to make the drive, but it was definitely like another way of doing it. And it's kind of like you almost gotta, if you go to Alaska enough times, eventually you gotta have to do the drive just so that you've like can have an appreciation for the landmass between population yeah. centers there. It's vast. And just the size of the province of BC. I mean, we're like,
yeah,
within like most of the stuff we do is like within like 150 miles of the US border or something, you know, whereas
the Canadian border, you mean?
Well,
right. The US,
yeah,
the,
yeah, US okay, Canadian border.
Right.
But, I mean, you're driving basically 4 days up, but the reason we did it that year is because, Casey Dean and Wiley Miller basically put together this trip to go sled skiing in Haines.
Hmm.
So we, and Casey had actually been there the year before filming with Blank, I think the first Blank movie.
Hmm.
So he kind of had a little beta on the situation and sort of knew some stuff to you know, do.
Yeah.
And, it was
he
pretty
sledding there that
yeah.
the previous year?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So he knew the deal yeah. getting and into Wiley those zones and I on had, a sled.
Wiley and I had been there in 2009 for the refresh trip with heli outfit, but
right.
I mean, it sounded awesome because it's just like a very appealing, like again, like an adventure.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like a different way to do Alaska and do it way more like on the ground, you're in it situation.
So you had no helis that whole trip?
No, zero yeah. helis. What we did, so we drove. Casey was kind enough to throw my sled on his sled deck. So I drove with him, and Wiley drove with his Bigfoot camper in tow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we drove up to Whitehorse, Yukon, rented an RV, and then drove that to Haines Pass. So we had a camper. Damn. Yeah.
So you were like truly self-contained this whole mish.
Pretty self-contained.
And a teepee.
And right. a teepee, yeah. So yeah. Mason Michon, who's, yeah, no, that's a very, how could I forget the teepee? Of course. That's like the symbolic, that's like our
epicenter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of the whole trip. But yeah, Mason Michon, the photographer from Whistler, joined us as well. He was an awesome dude. And he actually has like First Nation connection.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, he could get cheap gasoline and tobacco products if you want yeah. on all the various First Nation communities all the way through northern BC. Dope. But yeah, he has been this teepee thing he's been doing for years, and it's like a pretty awesome. He sets it up in the backcountry somewhere, actually with Roy Bushfield, who we were talking about earlier, good buddies. But yeah, he brought a teepee along as well. That he set up on Haynes Pass. And he was actually living in that thing. We were not. We were in the white man teepee.
Yeah.
But,
well, yeah. I mean, what was it like getting into that terrain that you'd been in, you know, flying over it numerous times, or terrain of the same scale, and having to like watch your buddies fucking boot pack these lines? Like, it's got to be a completely different experience.
It's a super different experience. I mean, everyone that had, we were far from the first people to go to try to climb up Alaska lines, like human powered. But
yeah,
obviously plenty of people have done that. And I think that purists will claim that's the only true way to ride a line. But it certainly is way more real, and you're putting yourself out there way more. Because we're pretty high accomplished risk. Snowmobilers yeah. at that point, and we're ready to take on, like, you know, we're experienced with glacial travel and getting into like safe routes to get as high up as you can go or whatever. But yeah, it's just bigger there, and like when you're
Alaska's big. Yeah,
it just is bigger. Yeah. Even though, I mean, you're like on Haynes Pass, it's still Canada. It's like it's not truly Alaska in a lot of ways, but it is. And we ended up spending a lot of time in the U.S. side, but I was kind of on not pins and needles, but definitely there's this like low hum of anxiety the whole trip, because you're camping out, you're waiting for weather, which seriously was bad that year. We had like 2.5 days of shooting for out of like 25 days or something like that. So you're just like sitting in a camper kind of thinking about what to do. And then when you do it, it's fucking scary. So it's like, it's never like,
and it makes the pressure that much more.
Yeah. And then you're like anticipating the scare.
Sounds wonderful.
It just is scarier than being in a helicopter. Cause you're basically, when you go out there with a helicopter, even in the worst case scenario, something bad happens, you have the fastest way to get in and out of there and get rescued. You have what would come and rescue you with you.
Right.
So it's like
safety net.
As much as you can have in that scenario. Yeah. Yes.
And usually, you know, trained guides, that their job is to be trained guides. They're not part of a film crew. They're not either hiking or trying to document it. So we're putting ourselves out there, and it just felt that way. It felt like we're out there. And
yeah, no, you're sitting at the bottom of the line being like, oh, if the cornice fucking goes and like
totally,
people
man.
Get knocked down, there's no backup. That's me. Like,
yeah, that's us. And again, we felt like we were like we had enough trust and enough like trust in each other's skills to do it. And I mean, like, I don't know if I had the perfect skills. Wiley was teaching me rope skills, like leading up to that trip to do a crevasse rescue, which honestly, if I had to do it, I don't know if I could. Like, I don't have the...
That shit's crazy complicated.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, I don't have the rope skills necessarily, but you're just... Especially when they're climbing, we were not climbing. Mason and I were just watching through basically binoculars, like watching them climb up these lines. And filming it. I mean, we did get into some cool stuff. We also got into a pretty scary moment where Casey got into an avalanche.
The one where he gets sloughed out? Or?
Yeah. Which you can't see in the shot because it's such weird light. Mm. But that's a pretty good size avalanche that he set off there and got ultimately like swept up in. It was just a weird day where there's kind of a greenhousing effect going on. There's like this misty cloud layer.
Mm.
And then the sun basically heats it up and like heats up all the air underneath the cloud. It's not strong enough to block the sun.
Mm.
So I was like greenhousing all these mountains high up. And it was a bad situation, but it was warming up fast. Usually a ripe,
so it wasn't
ripe for an avalanche.
Is that just slough or did was no, it? No.
That's a full off a slab. On slab rip out.
Damn. Cause that actually, was not my impression watching it.
No, you can't see it again because of the light. It propagated probably like 300 feet across or something like that. Yeah. Oof. But it wasn't super deep, but because the conditions were not excellent that year. But and it was a very good scenario. He got swept over a cliff, but it was the opposite of a terrain trap. So it was like where everything fans out instead of gets channeled into one place. So all that snow dispersed into a wider area than what it ripped out from. So, which was good. And it basically, Casey was never under any snow. I mean, it was fucking scary as shit for sure. Cause here I am like filming a slide. You can see it rip out and it kind of happened in slow motion.
Mm.
So I was very aware of what was going on. And then it's like, here we are. And I actually felt really good about our response there. Cause Wiley and John Spriggs, who was actually there as well, were like, boom, like, they had their sleds like started and were moving into the, you know, the exit point there where Casey would, you know, we last saw him or whatever, like before anything even settled. So it was, and Mason and I were not very far behind them. So I think we had a really good reaction, but it was fucking terrifying for sure. And, again, you're on your own out there, like full straight up. There was also like another, we actually had heard it like the blank crew, Alexi Godbu and Stan Ray and Josh Dyack are up there, and Scotty
Scotty Titterington?
Titterington, yeah, was filming them, but they had like a programmable radio where they're getting signals from the AK Haley skiing, and Bodie Merrill, the snowboarder, had popped off a cornice. Similar to what happened with us in the refresh year,
Stefan and Wyatt,
except that he Stefan got swept down probably 800 feet and got buried in a secondary triggered avalanche, like 8 feet upside down head first.
What you guys were lucky enough to have avoided in that scenario.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they got him out within like minutes, but, and it was a full, I mean, Bodie's still kicking and
but you guys
shredding.
We heard about it.
It was a very, there was a lot of peripheral stuff going on that made the dread pretty fucking real.
Jeez.
Because that happened, you know, he had lung bruising from inhaling snow and he had to get lifted out to Juneau.
Jeez.
But then there's a fatality on the pass the same time. And this guy, Max, from Whistler, like kind of.
A sledder or?
A skier.
Really?
I wasn't familiar with. But they also pulled up with an RV, like a bit later than when we got there. And they were filming something and some little thing. He got, I mean, I don't know the exact details of what happened, but he basically got buried in a very small slide.
Mm.
And we had RCMP, like the Canadian police, like come asking about it, and we didn't even know what was going on. They just were responding to a spot, like one of the Garmin
GPS emergency
devices. Yeah. And, you know, this is like 3 hours after somebody had done it.
Yeah.
So, and
Jesus.
That ended up being, he would passed away in that. It was very fucking heavy, but.
I mean, this is part of like your, you know, progression over the year before as well of like truly abandoning any inclination to film street and be like, yeah, I want to do backcountry all the time. This is what I'm drawn towards. This is what I want to do. And like,
yeah,
I think it's real. And I think in some ways important to hear you grapple with this shit, because that's
the reality.
Yeah. This is the base reality of what you got to be thinking about if you want to try to get into it. Because you don't have to go to Alaska to have an emergency situation like that in the backcountry.
No. Go definitely do it not.
Vail Pass here in Colorado. Sure. Like, yeah, is the scary and sad reality of it. So
yeah,
I think it is, as much as it's fucking like hard to hear you listen to that because it's real and raw. But it's like it is the unseen shit behind these movies that have been getting made for, you know, this is not a new thing. It's not like, oh, people are just starting to get dying avalanches in Alaska in 2016 or whatever. Like, this is how it works. And exactly. And if you want to go do it right.
High risk endeavor.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you want to participate in high risk endeavors, you better have trust in who you're going with and an understanding of what you're getting into.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, it's
a team situation.
Apex activity, or close to it. I mean, it's really not, because we're still motor powered and, you know, all this stuff. But point of putting all your skills to the test and everything you just said, having trust in who you're working with and making very wise fucking decisions for sure, or as best you damn can. But that was definitely it was an experience that I won't forget, that whole trip, for just because of, I don't know, how close you are to like just a very visceral place and like situation. But on the flip side of that, we also were racing helicopters on really nice days as well.
That's dope.
Which was
like just mopping across the glacier, watching it above you,
or
like
going for the same terrain and watching these dudes in helis just get to it long before you can on a
so
sled.
We eventually moved off the pass and into the town of Haines proper, because we just needed civilization and Wi-Fi and good groceries and all that stuff.
People.
Yeah, because otherwise, and people, yeah. And because you're just going to be sitting in an RV and you're going to run out of like
card games to play and
like
patience,
like downloads on your laptop to play.
But
in the town it was just hectic, because there's like, it felt like the entire snowboard community was up there. They had all, Tanner Hall was up there as well, they had all dropped so much money on heli time, and that was the one thing. And the conditions were not like, you know, I'm talking like tens of thousands of dollars, the conditions were failing. They were re-upping deposits, like doubling down on $5,000 or $10,000, and we were like, thank God we're doing what we're doing, because
we spent a couple grand on gas to get here.
That was it. And like, we were just, and that was part of that money was just for the experience. Like, it really wasn't, because we had just come off of Eagle Pass, and which was
it was before this.
So it was like hands down the most productive you know, big mountain, if you will, I would say any film trip, like most productive film trip I've pretty much ever had.
Yeah, so I mean, like the parks, anything the we got speaks for that,
anything we got after that was pure bonus. So we were, this Alaska thing, like we were never sweating shots, which is actually really important for our, like everything for our, well, you know, mental health up there for sure. But it was also just like, oh, thank God we're not spending $20,000 to not do anything. But so, you know, there's like two good days of the whole April. This takes place over the month of April.
Right.
And like, if there's two sunny days, all the helicopters fly out. They bring in more helicopters for these guys who are desperate, and they all fly out to the same zones. And we're like, on one of these days, we are also trying to snowmobile to these zones, but also not really knowing all these zones that well. So we don't
like, we're like knowing a couple.
You're
but
looking like a, you're looking, you know, on Alaska size, you're looking like a mile away, and you're like, damn, that's a sick line. And then like 45 minutes later, you're like closer, and then this heli just goes, lands on top, and then you see them ride it before you can even like think about boot packing up. And I was like, damn, that looks pretty sick.
It was like, I did all right there.
It was actually funny. Like, we sledded up to this zone that we saw from pretty very, we had actually seen from an airplane because we did some airplane recon, but
dope.
Yeah, with Drake, who's the man. But we get up to it, and there's a heli sitting there, and these snowbirds like session in a wind lip. And there's Gigi Roof and Dan Breezy.
Oh,
and it was like, and they come, they like, oh, and Kazu, I think, was there as well. Yeah, and it was for the it was Kazu, Gigi, and Breezy. They were there for, and actually, my buddy Justin was filming them for the Union movie Stronger. And it was like, yo, what up, guys? And they like, we're out in fucking the Alaska like terrain, right. And like they just like are hitting this wind lip. Actually, not, it's not going super well. And they just like snowboard down to us, like as if we are buddies. Like they're like, yo, they're like, man, we wish like we were with you guys. This looks a lot funner, just like sledding around here, and not like how, because they had definitely, they were the guys that had spent $20,000 or whatever. Yeah. We're like, yeah, I kind of wish we were you guys right now. But it was a it was a very funny situation, because you know we were just like all out there with different means, but yeah, that pretty much sums up that
word. I think it's an interesting point of discussion, too, because, like, snowmobile technology has advanced so much in the past 10 years that you can really open up these places that people were, they were exclusively heli before. And, like,
yeah, like, very much so.
And in turn, that opens it up to the layman who can't afford a heli, who, yeah. And in looking at you guys doing that shit, it looks like the dopest shit ever and, like, super casual. And, I mean, fucking, like, the Strictly Business dudes went to Valdez last year in like their first year.
I was terrified for him.
Yeah. That like first year filming a movie. I'm sure they have backcountry experience and sledding experience. I don't know those dudes, but right. Like that's about the gnarliest shit you can get into in the Northern like in this continent. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like,
I know Benny and Ethan pretty well. Awesome. Awesome guys. Yeah. And I was definitely nervous for them. I thought that they were biting off a little more than they could chew or should chew.
Valdez is a little more user friendly in the sense that you can go, you can only do what you want to do. Like you can go 100 feet.
Right. Or, the pass is, makes shit a little more user friendly. You can do stuff on the pass
that isn't like glacial travel and whatnot. Or you can go 150 miles.
I mean, those dudes went to the books. So like,
that's not that far.
No. Really?
No.
It's like you can see it from the pretty easily. But
no,
still,
you can. I mean, we've helicoptered like 20 times further than the books or whatever. Yeah. Like,
but I mean, that used to be like the farthest shit you can get to when it was all just ski touring. Like that. It's. I mean, it's all relative.
It's all relative for sure. No, I mean, I'm not saying it's like any just anyone can go sled out to the books. I mean, anyone probably could, but it's dumb because you are traveling on crevasse ridden glaciers and you're again exposed out there, but I mean, good snowmobiles have definitely changed that,
yeah,
for sure.
Crazy times.
Yeah,
crazy segment
for better and worse.
Yeah, I honestly, like, yeah,
Eagle Pass is sick though. I don't know if you want to touch on that experience a little bit more before we wrap up.
I mean, it was just again like one of the the only bummer there was that Tanner Rainville blew his knee out, but which was like a tough deal. He did it like just on that wind lip in the movie where he does a 5 and he does a 3 to like 180 first hit, and then a 5 to 180
with all the crazy shit, the rad lines he flashed.
And yeah, we just had just like we had one of the best filming days I've ever had, like that morning, and then he like third or fourth hit on that thing. He's dropping like a two line, like a double drop into that wind lip, does a 180. And then he was kind of knuckling, like doing the knuckle revert or whatever.
Yeah.
And Jason, he's a king of reverts, but, and switch landings and all that stuff. But yeah, he did a 180 bounce to revert. And just like, for whatever reason, that snow caught his ski and twisted his leg around. But again,
shit happens.
Yeah, shit happens. And you had a heli to get him out of there. And it was very unlife-threatening or anything like that. And it opened up the door for Thane to come in.
I was going to say, as much of a travesty as that was and a shitty thing to happen to somebody. Well, for one, it was at the end of the season. So thankfully, like,
you know, timing wise, it could have been worse.
Yeah.
But what that really did is Friedel, I don't want to jump in on your story here, man, but that definitely gave Thane Rich an opportunity.
Yeah. Like, I mean, so Tanner's not replaceable in any way. And he's actually one of my favorite skiers to watch and film with and ski with. So that was a fucking bummer.
I'll second that motion.
Sitting there sharing a hotel with him and he's icing his knee. And it's like just this, you know, we came from a very high to like kind of a low, but basically it was like the conditions were so good and we still had heli time. They needed to fill another seat.
Yep.
And Thane was in town. He was just kind of vagabonding it. There used to be this like camper lot up by Revelstoke Resort, which they have since shut the fuck down.
Yeah.
But, it was like everybody up there, Lucas Wachs, Carl Fosfet, like the whole, like, Ben Moxham, et cetera, but this whole crew would go up there and camp out and ski. And Thane was one of those people. And I had never worked with Thane. He was just always a dude that I knew shredded. And yeah, I mean, basically I was like, hey man, do you want to come heli skiing? And we got a spot for you. Like, here's your time. And then he was like, I don't know. Like,
what?
Like, well, because he just saw dollar signs. Like, he, you know, he's counting. He's eating like canned soup or whatever. Like, he's not.
True. This is not like a comp heli spot. This is like
no.
a spot in the heli that
but it,
someone needs to pay for still.
Yeah. But, yeah. We ultimately gave him like a fat. It was like, okay, so like, what will it
subsidized.
Take?
Subsidized.
Yeah. It was like, will it subsidize? Like, please, like, just find a number.
It's good.
Come basically, on. Like, find a number that you can, like, yeah, figure out and do. Mm-hmm. And then, like, mm-hmm. we'll try to figure out the rest for you. But, yeah. Well, Josh. Yeah. Josh is the man at just
out there with the legal pad.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Let me crunch these numbers really
two
quick.
Two plus two is four. But, dude, I mean, fucking, it's Thane Rich. I just knew he was keen for that and ready for that. But I was also like, dude, like, I was like, so he finally said yes. And I was kind of sweating it too. I was like, fuck. Because the conditions, again, amazing. And we definitely needed to fill a seat. And because otherwise it was just Wiley. Need somebody to ride with.
Yeah.
And so Thane comes in the morning. And I'm like, he has a reputation for being like pretty like no brakes, no holds barred, just like full throttle and like the definition of loose but lit.
Mm-hmm.
And which is not always good if you're like a brand new guy on like a helicopter.
Yeah.
Cause that every your adrenaline is already running. There's already a lot of like intensity and pressure. So it's like, dude, take it as easy as you want. Please like take it more mellow than you possibly can. Cause you want to ease into this. There's a lot of intensity. Everything looks different because you're flying over it, and like a 15-foot cliff might actually be a 50-foot cliff.
Usually, that's
pick the smallest line. Like, take it. Like, don't worry about any sort of this heli time or anything like that. So, first line, he's like, "Yeah, totally, man."
He's like, I just listened to everything you said, and I don't give a fuck.
First line, he's off this like little spine drop, which turned into like a 55-foot air and or something like that. And it's just like exploded on the landing. He's like, yeah, man, you're kind of right about that stuff. But he also had a boot. He had a boot that wasn't even working. He had it. It was broken. And he's like,
well, like a buckle was missing or like,
dude, it like wasn't the structure of the boot seemed to have been, I believe, was broken.
Compromised. Like, shall we say
He had three ski straps and some duct tape holding that thing together.
No shit,
and we
dude.
Added like after that guy, she's like, "I need. Does anyone have like more ski straps? Like,
no,
need to like ratchet this thing up,
dude, like gaff tape,
dude." But yeah, he went on to take.
Seems like he pulled it together.
He pulled it together for sure. He figured it out, and like, I mean, his first-hand experience is just like, yeah, here goes nothing. Like, I don't really know like how to adjust my riding or anything really, or even like walk into this like with a, you know, a tender approach or whatever. I'm just gonna like ride or just do whatever. Like, I don't know, it was just like getting dropped into the pool as a baby or whatever.
Yeah.
But
Again, I really wanted to like it.
Well, that's a thing is they teach infants to swim. Like we're talking infants by throwing them into pools. That is a thing. It's fucking crazy. Google it. We're talking like,
okay.
You ever like heard the term sink or swim?
Like three.
But I've never heard it applied to babies.
Nah, babies. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yo.
Yes. That's a thing. Like YouTube. Okay. Do it.
Okay. But I seriously, we had such good weather and stuff that I wasn't stressing. I was like, dude, you can take like 5 warm-up laps if you want. Like, I don't care.
Yeah. But hang on 1 second. Oh, those 5 warm-up laps, that's $3,748.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, but how much money did you get out of the like that Ender Line with like giganto double stager to insano backslap? Like, oh my god, man.
Yeah, that was the next morning. So that day was crazy. The first day out with Thane was crazy. He actually got the line that actually ends his part, which is like a crazy spine transfer thing. Mm-hmm. But the next morning we went out to this zone south. And he's like, yeah, I'm gonna hit that like second line of the day, hits that double stager and went like 3 times as big as he thought, and certainly I thought, or the heli pilot thought. We're watching the baby video here.
Josh is about to show us how babies get thrown into poles.
This is riveting entertainment. Great.
It's got 2 million views. And this child can't even walk. And somehow it ends up in the pool.
No one threw him. Oh, God.
I mean, that's freaky, right? That's like an infant in a onesie. Yeah. Look at that. That's crazy. Anyway, that's a thing. Back to skiing.
But yeah, I mean, Thane has one gear.
Yeah.
And it's a high one for sure.
Yeah, dude. That was a hell of a way to make a debut hell of a way to make a debut.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I've never been one, like, I've never filmed that kind of big mountain, or, you know, I call it medium mountain skiing. But which is like, you know, the Seth Morrison approach of like just the biggest, nastiest airs are like
that's
the fastest
perfect comparison.
Lines.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, like this is basically like filming Seth Morrison or something right now. But he will say that he was never trying to do any of that stuff. It just turned out to be way rowdier than he ever anticipated. So
I wonder if Seth would say the same thing.
Put a big explanation point on that trip. Yeah, craziness for sure.
Yeah, it's a sick, very sick way to end the movie.
Yeah, I had two polar opposite trips to BC that year. I started off the year in the Kootenays with Sammy Ortlieb and Rob Hewley doing like super mellow.
Building snowmen, catching snowflakes on your
tongue.
The tongues.
Chillest like ski tour access, like backyard house skiing, which is like, in my opinion, maybe one of the funnest things I can be a part of and like the illest vibe. But you go from that to like, high intensity,
high octane,
heli filming and all that. But it made for a really interesting year for sure. And kind of like, did a lot of shit across the board there. But pleasure, baby. Did we do it?
Yeah, man. We didn't cover it all, but we covered what we needed to do.
I think we're running long.
Yeah, and you guys need to go get some sleep so we could finish making movie. This movie.
One more shout out to Helen Gillen Moore, our voice talent, who absolutely crushed it. It was actually really funny because we found her online through this just like online casting agency, and we gave her the thumbs up based on a few samples that she read. And so she's flying blind. It's like the description is like ski movie. And she's reading like a paragraph about pleasure, like the intro.
Right.
And when she started to figure out like what we were actually doing with her voice, she's like, this is the coolest thing ever. And you guys are rock stars and this is amazing. And I'm coming to the fucking premiere.
Yeah.
And she flew out and partied with us.
Dope.
And I think her mind was completely blown. She was so excited, and we definitely kept in touch. She actually came back to the premiere the next year, didn't she?
She may have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she came 2 years in a row.
She made a habit of it.
Oh.
On that note, see you next week for Habit.
Thanks for listening, y'all. Much appreciate it. Don't forget to go check out our website, www.level1.ski, and find a Romance Premier stop near you. If you want to watch this movie, Pleasure, go to the direct podcast URL. That is podcast.level1.ski. You can find this movie there and a link to all of the movies that we have released this summer and this fall. So go run it up. Go show your friends. Go buy something from the store and support independent filmmaking. And we will catch you next week talking about Habit. Cheers, everybody.